This week's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the Tom Savini Special Effects Makeup Program and the George A. Romero Filmmaking Program. Both are part of the Douglas Education Center in Manesson, Pennsylvania. Perhaps there is no program in the world more defined by the people inside it or by the spirit, energy, and imagination that they embody. Join the thousands of students from all over the world who have embarked on the journey that is Tom Savini Special Effects Makeup Program. Let us help you hone your skills as we teach you how to bring your drawings to life and nightmares to reality. And at George A. Romero's filmmaking program, your experience goes far beyond filmmaking. You have the opportunity to work alongside special effect makeup artists to bring your characters and films to life. You are the storyteller. You have a passionate message to tell, and you are the one who brings our greatest fears, our greatest hopes, and our greatest loves to reality. For more information on the Tom Savini Special Effects Makeup Program and the George A. Romero Filmmaking Program, for more information on the Tom Savini Special Makeup Effects Program and the George A. Romero Filmmaking Program, please visit the Douglas Education Center website at www.dec.edu. Hashtag make monsters and hashtag make movies. And I'll also say that a couple of years ago, I actually had the opportunity to go there. They invited me out. I got to go visit the Douglas Education Center. They have some freaking crazy awesome facilities. Like, it was amazing. Like, just great equipment, great students, great teachers. It was a wonderful trip.
The Shockwaves team is heading to Texas Frightmare this May, and we hope to see you all there. Texas Frightmare is the Southwest's premier horror convention and is now celebrating their 13th year. They always have the best guests, the best panels, and you don't want to miss it. Texas Frightmare will be showing a sneak preview of Arrow's upcoming restored Last House on the Left release, and they will have cast members Jeremy Rain and Mark Scheffler. Other guests include Clive Barker, several of the Cenobites, including Doug Bradley, all the kids from the It Losers Club, Tobin Bell, Shawnee Smith, Ron Perlman, Charlie Band, Brad Dourif, Katie Featherstone, and many more. Head to www.texasfrightmareweekend.com and get your tickets now. We will all be there with our own booth. We're going to have our own panel on Sunday.
We're going to have some horror trivia.
We're
going to be hosting panels.
And Elric wants you to touch his face.
Yeah, I do.
Purposely. That was so demure you said that.
He didn't, though.
Touch my face.
I'll do one more. And the Shockwaves team is going to be, well, three out of the four, and that's not bad, is going to be in Chattanooga for the film festival. We are really psyched. We're also hearing like a lot of friends and other podcasts. Just seems like a lot of cool people are going to be there for this period, a lot of filmmakers, a lot of great cinema. I think this is going to be a really good time. If you haven't got a pass yet, you should go check it out. I know there's still passes available, and it's like, you know, 4 or 5 days of barbecue and cinema. What could go wrong?
I know. And they're showing some amazing films there, not just mine. There's a lot of other really good
stuff. There's an Estonian movie
well.
I'm dying to see.
I can't wait to see.
People tell me it's great.
The Ranger looks really good, so yeah. I'm psyched to check out a lot of stuff. So, yeah, it's going to be fun.
Okay, and welcome to episode number 89 of Shockwaves. I'm your host, Rob G. I'm sitting here with Mr. Elric Kane.
Hey, man. How's it going?
It's going great.
Yeah?
Chattanooga, baby.
I know, yeah. We finally get a holiday.
We'll be working the whole time.
You call that work?
I can't wait to go away.
Elric,
work.
He's going to be drunk, like, with a chicken leg in his hand the whole time.
Oh, man, that's true.
Yeah. Elric Kane Unleashed at a convention is something else.
Liquor.
Ryan Turek is
Give
with us
liquor.
As well.
Yeah, man.
What's up, man?
Weinstein's owe me money.
I know. We just saw this article.
Apparently, on a list.
Made it.
The Weinsteins.
You've officially
owe me
made
money.
It when the Weinsteins owe you money. I guess.
Me and the world.
Yeah. They owe a lot of people money for ads to a certain movie that Blumhouse may have also been a part of.
Yeah, that too.
But anyways, also Rebecca McKendry.
Hello, guys.
Welcome. And here we are, another week, 89th episode, kind of crazy. Yeah. Right off the top, a few things to mention. Cavity Colors. Head over to cavitycolors.com now because Shockwaves merchandise. They still have t-shirts left, both of our Shockwaves logo, of the shocker design by Devin Whitehead. They have baseball tee versions of both.
Those baseball ringer tees are so cool.
I love them. Yeah,
I can't wait.
I ordered two of those as well. And then the pin, and they're just about to run out of certain sizes, so this is kind of your last chance. So order them now. Represent Shockwaves. Come see us at a convention wearing your official Shockwaves merch.
And Elric will let you touch his face.
I will.
Apparently.
And if we don't buy these, they will never make the Turk plush doll. So please support them. We want that plush doll. It's going to be good.
When we get made into those pop figurines with the giant heads, that's when you know you've made it.
Oh, we could take that to the convention when you can't come. We got the little Turk plush doll.
Yeah.
I was going to say, you're going to get so sick by being touched.
I really
like, you're going to come back with a plague. Right.
I want one of our listeners to do, there's actually like an art form of it where they like crochet geek figures, like you can crochet like a Cthulhu. God. I want a crocheted Turk.
Basically, you're telling everybody at Texas Frightmare to come with
Turk
homemade
dolls.
Goods.
Homemade Turk dolls.
Oh, voodoo dolls.
We're going to make an altar in the boardroom of
just
Turk
give me,
dolls.
Just make me a Turk cake.
Wow.
And we will eat it at Texas.
Happening.
Yeah, so Cavity Colors, get your Shockwaves merch.
Get it.
I wanted to mention, since we're a little indie company, Imitation Girl, which is a film, my first acquisition in the world of acquisitions, is now on VOD.
At Epic. Oh,
cool. At Epic, my first acquisition for Epic Pictures for Dread Central Presents. And it's very different. Actually, Patrick Bromley from F This Movie gave a really fantastic review.
Cool.
So I really appreciate that and basically called out, this is not what I would expect, and that's interesting, and that's exactly why I picked it. It's not exactly genre, but it's a really wonderful filmmaker who will be popping by in the show eventually, who I think I'm just very impressed that this is her first movie. Can't wait to see what she does next, which is a straight horror movie. And so please support independent movies like that. Imitation Girl's on VOD right now. And that's that. And we've seen a ton of stuff. So who wants to kick it off?
I want Turek to kick it off with Cold Hell.
Oh,
yes. All right, let's do it.
So Cold Hell, based on our ad buy from last week in which we advertised this film, I had a free night and I popped in Cold Hell on Shudder. Press the button.
Yeah.
This is a movie I knew nothing about.
Me neither.
Stefan Ruzowitzki directed it, and I did not know that he did Anatomy in 2000.
Anatomy.
So did I.
I was going to say it seemed way too polished to have been a first film.
Yeah. Exactly.
And it kind of fell off the face of the earth pretty quickly. But I remember
Anatomy.
I remember enjoying it when it came
out.
It
got sequels.
Right?
Yeah, Anatomy 2. But I remember at the time, like, discovering Anatomy and going, wow, this film is polished and cool and it hits all the right beats. So cut to many years later and I'm seeing another one of his films and being incredibly surprised.
Oh, yeah.
What a ride this film is. If you guys don't know, it's about a Turkish female cab driver who...
At some point she says she's Ukrainian. I didn't understand that because she was clearly Turkish. And they go, oh, are you Ukrainian? And that's what she said. Maybe she's lying. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, the kind of theme for our main character is she's always fighting against the system and she's fighting against men.
It's actually perfect for right now. It's like the perfect movie of today.
Yes, it is perfect. But basically she comes home after a long night of cab driving. And she looks across the way into the next building over and sees a dead woman laying on the floor, brutally mutilated. And then in a beautiful stroke of just, blocking, she sees in the darkness, staring right back at her, is the killer.
Because she's right under the light. She's right under her light.
She is right under her light, and he is not. He's staring at her.
Yeah.
And from that point on, it becomes a cat and mouse chase as the serial killer comes after her. But she's balancing taking on her niece, dealing with her family, dealing with the cops, dealing with her boss, all these things. And, man, there is some... It is a pure giallo meets,
it's almost
cool
like giallo meets The Raid.
Yeah.
Because every time there's a fight scene, it's really intense.
Yeah.
And one of the things you didn't say is, first meet her, before she goes home to see the serial killer, the first thing she does is, she's a taxi and she kind of pulls down an alley and there's some assholes who won't get out of their car in front of her. She walks, and she's very unassuming. She's kind of, small frame. Yeah. And she goes up to the mask and leave. And when the guy won't leave, she just beats the living shit out of him, like complete ninja, like The Raid or something. And it sets the tone of this real bad.
What we learn is that she's trained in Thai kickboxing, Thai fighting.
But she takes it too far.
She takes it too far.
Anger.
But the great thing is you just see her wail on dudes.
Oh, yeah.
She uses her legs, and then once she's got her legs wrapped around you, she just starts pounding on your face.
Yeah.
And I remember Ciara came in halfway through, And she was immediately hooked.
Yeah.
I brought her up to speed and she was just like, oh my God, what's going on? And by the very end, she was literally off the couch, standing in the middle of the living room, screaming, going, kick his ass, kick his ass. And I'm like, oh my God, sit down, watch the movie.
She's one of the best characters I've seen in a while. Like, just surprising and her actions are great and it's fun and unpredictable.
There's almost like a Luc Besson, you know what? It's like a Giallo meets Luc Besson action film.
Yeah.
You know?
It has all those elements.
Yeah.
It's a really nice surprise. That was a really
fun beautifully
one.
Shot.
Yeah. Yeah. But it feels big also. Some of the explosions and fight scenes seem very, it didn't seem like a cheap movie.
Yeah, yeah. But it works on both a horror film and action film level. And it's almost the color palette to the film, which did, if I don't know if you noticed this, you know, he washes the picture in a lot of purples and blues and a lot of the nighttime photography, but it kind of gets lost along the way.
Yeah.
And I kind of wish he maintained that all the way through.
It's like the opening where the killer's being established. It becomes, it's more moody and giallo, and then it becomes almost more corporate even because what she's chasing seems a little bit more neutered or something. But it's a really nice surprise. Like, this was one, I think we must have been thinking around the same time because when you posted, I had just finished it and I was like, no, this is really, I think Sam Zimmerman had said, like, this film kicks
Sam,
ass.
Yeah, and, Sam, one of the main curators over at Shudder. This was his baby, apparently.
This sounds like a Sam film.
But I think for people who dig action, I think they're going to dig it. She's just a perfect character for right now. It feels like this would make a lot of people feel good.
But and also it's more cohesive and linear than a Sam film.
Okay, I'm in. That totally makes sense. Now I'm in.
Not art house at all.
No.
It's not even slightly.
Love you, Sam.
Yeah. No, this is a good one. I totally agree. That was good.
Okay, well, I'll go next since this one was giallo-ish. I do not know what the fuck I watched, guys. Dance Macabre. This is the Robert Englund film from the 90s.
Yeah, I never saw that. I remember that.
So this recently got a Blu-ray release, and I don't know how recently because it had been sitting on my to-watch stack for a while now. And finally I was like, okay, you know what? I'm going to watch this. Has anyone seen this?
No, but what... I came across it. Is it just who put it out?
Okay, so
somebody just put it out on Blu-ray.
No, it wasn't Screen Factory. I want to say it's like MGM or something like that. Look it up if you wouldn't mind, Rob.
Oh, I saw it in Amoeba. I saw it in the Amoeba stacks.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this one, it opens with Robert Englund as this dancer, choreographer type, and he's with this woman on a motorcycle, and then it crashes, and you get the idea that she's been injured. And then it fast forward, and he now runs a dance studio in Russia or Germany. I can't remember which one it is. It feels very Suspiria-ish. Mm. And he's bringing in this whole slate of dancers, and he's become obsessed with one in particular. And then there's also this woman who appears, woman in quotes, appears every so often. And also she's like the grand dame of the theater. I think she's like headmistress, and she also kind of advises the girls. And then suddenly some of the girls start dying. And it's totally giallo, like full leather gloves. It's shot very much like Suspiria. The only problem is that the twist that everyone remembers from this movie, there's a twist. And I use the word twist very loosely because the very first frame of the movie, you're like, oh, hey, that's... And then it's done. And then I kept thinking that can't be the twist because it's so obvious. And it is the twist. And so, but that said, this movie is fucking nuts and firing on all cylinders the whole time. And the acting is so overwrought and dramatic. And then I looked it up and it is directed by, his name's Graydon Clark. And this is the guy who did Satan's Cheerleaders and Without Warning. And this was actually developed as a sequel to Robert Englund's Phantom of the Paradise and just never.
Phantom of the Opera.
Thank you. Phantom of the Opera and just never became that. But I mean, there is just weird stuff in this. There's like, and again, it's all overwrought. Like, there's the girl is sent to this ballet school by her father, and she looks at him and is like, I don't want to do ballet anymore, Dad. I want to do my type of dancing. And 10 minutes later, she's doing this like sleazy ass striptease to public domain metal music, and it's being cross cut with this brutal killing. And so the striptease is completely diffusing the killing, and it's just weird.
It sounds like someone was trying to do the old Argento thing.
It feels
heavy metal.
I mean, there are moments where you're just like, oh, this is Suspiria. Because, like, you'll be staring at these close ups of Robert Englund's face, and you'll see red and blue lights crisscrossing behind him. Weird. And it's got some synthiness to the score. So it really feels like he was trying to channel Suspiria. But it's even weirder than Suspiria and feels more, or I'll say less cohesive than Suspiria, if that's possible.
Yeah, so, this is from our friends at Scream Factory.
Oh, it is a Scream Factory.
Yeah, it came out at the very end of January from Scream Factory, and it's originally from 92.
Yep.
And I remember this because I remember it was around the Phantom of the Opera, yeah. which is what, like 89 or so? Mm-hmm. And that's so interesting because I worked on the Phantom of the Opera disc, and the thing that got England to do that movie, above all else, was the sequel, because he was pitched two movies. And the way they just, you know, it's Dwight Little, the guy that did Halloween 4. Oh. And the way that he kind of pitched what the modern day, like the original Phantom of the Opera was set in period time. And basically the opening and ending of that movie was kind of the kernel for what the sequel would have been, which would have been a modern day story. And like that's what England was excited for. And of course, they never got to it. Mm. So I find it fascinating that you're saying this feels like it's the sequel to that.
It definitely,
because it was probably him being like, "Well, I'll do it. I wanted to make that movie now."
It has nothing to do with Phantom of the Opera whatsoever, other than it's very theatrical because it's a dance studio and he's playing this kind of choreographer, artistic guy. But that said, this movie is fucking nuts. Like, you need to watch this just on a holy shit, I can't believe that this actually got made at this level. There's just so much weirdness in it that when combined, like, I couldn't believe what I was watching most of the time. There were moments that I was laughing out loud and then I was just shocked by what I was seeing. There's exploitive sex moments. There's like a crazy, like, over the top shower scene that goes on for like 10 minutes. And yeah, you got to see this one, guys. Dance Macabre. 92.
I'm in.
I'm amazed none of us have seen that.
Yeah.
That's kind of amazing.
Elric?
What about Rob? You?
Oh,
Cold Hell.
You talk Cold Hell. I'm sorry. Well, I finally got the Stars app through Amazon because I have Amazon Prime, and it's a pretty good deal when it comes to these cable networks. It's like $8 for a month, and caught up on Ash versus Evil Dead Season 3. Mm-hmm. I loved I pretty much loved the first season. There's a bit in the middle where I thought it kind of, you know, meandered, but I loved how it started, and I thought it ended really strong. I thought Season 2 was a blast from start to finish. Mm-hmm. Except the finale, which completely shit the bed.
Yeah.
Mm. And then there was a lot of controversy because the showrunner had been let go right before the finale aired and had a very notorious interview go up that kind of got him in a lot of trouble, critiquing, obviously, Robert Tappert. He just said the producer and everybody put the blanks together. And but I think the reason I haven't been that adamant to jump into Season 3, I mean, look, it's Evil Dead. I love it. I want to see it. But because I was so disappointed, like, basically the entire Season 2 was set up and there was no punchline. And then when you hear the showrunner say, well, this is what my punchline is, and you're like, well, that sounds really awesome. So I was kind of almost like, well, I don't know. But anyway, I subscribed. I watched the first four episodes. It is an absolute blast. It's much like Season 2. I think it's just as great and just as fun. The whole kind of twist, it's not even a twist, but basically Ash is like now the town hero at Elk Grove. He has taken over his dad's hardware shop, which is part hardware shop, part sex toy
shop,
which is freaking hilarious. And then he finds out right at the beginning of Season 3 that he has a daughter. And so obviously evil's back. They're after him, his kin, his entire, you know, family line. And then there's just, you know, I'm amazed that in 30-minute chunks, they are able to infuse so much Evil Dead into the show. And I mean, in Season 2, by the second episode, they went so far with this whole morgue sequence, which
I think is the
funniest and probably one of the greatest Evil Dead moments ever. They come pretty close here because
there's some gnarly stuff in that one fight scene. Remember?
Well, in episode 2, he goes to a sperm bank. Let's just leave it at that.
They explore everything.
They really go everywhere there. But to me, the greatest thing was in Ash fashion, he decides, well, since I'm here, I'll take a magazine. And let's just say that the very voluptuous woman in the centerfold of the magazine might come alive through the magazine and taunt Ash. It's pretty amazing.
It's a good gag. It's a fun, great. Really,
that's
fun
the thing.
Gag.
It's like, man. Yeah. And I had actually texted Ryan about this because initially I'm watching the first episode of Season 3 and I'm like, is this, because it starts out very zany.
Yeah.
And I'm like, is this Evil Dead? And then, you know, my question to Ryan was, what is Evil Dead? Like, what do you think of, like, because if I watch the first movie and then this first scene from Ash vs. Evil Dead Season 3, they are nothing alike. Yeah. And so that's been my question. That was actually kind of what the showrunner was saying when he left Season 2. It was like, well, what is Evil Dead? Like, you know, I got in an argument with the powers that be about what it is. And it's so many different things now. Like, I don't know. Yeah. I think Army of Darkness, for better or worse, is the epitome of what people consider Evil Dead.
Mm-hmm. I would say so.
That version of Ash. That tone, right? I mean, kind of when you think Evil Dead,
well,
that's...
no one thinks the first film. Like, they always immediately gravitate to the more comedic side. And then I think that the slapstick of 2 was exploded in 3, and that's what everybody associates with it, is kind of that slapsticky
comedic
Well,
side.
I think it's the hammy outlandishness of Ash himself is what people embrace. And that's what we got in Army of Darkness. You know, Evil Dead 2, he was more of, he's the usual.
He's more maniacal.
He's maniacal. He's the common man. He's a little bit cool.
Yeah.
And funny then, shit's happening to him, but he's not being funny.
Exactly. Where he's being, he's full blown. But
I think he's oblivious to it now. But here's the thing I love about the show. And it is great. And I know everyone's saying it's in danger of getting canceled if more people don't watch. But quite frankly, I'd be okay with 3 years of extra. It's 30 more hours of Evil Dead. Yeah. There's no urgency to the story. It's just fun popcorn entertainment. But I love the Easter eggs. If you've been a diehard fan watching all along, like in season 2, you made a reference because they kind of ignore Army of Darkness. And then he's out of nowhere. He's like, oh, yeah, like that one time I went back in time. Yeah, I could totally do that. My favorite joke in this season so far was, I think he's back at his old high school. And he's like, yeah, I met my first Linda here. And I just lost it because I'm like, they're now acknowledging that 2 is canon. And he totally had a second Linda girlfriend. So if you love the movies, I think it's still a lot of fun. And again, I think the easiest way to watch it is if you already have Amazon Prime, it's $8 a month to just subscribe, and you can cancel at any point. So that's the way I watch it.
Were there ever rumors about part 2 of the actual remake movies? Has there ever been an update on that?
There hasn't been an update. I mean, like they say that it's something that's in development, but I can't imagine a world in which they'll circle back to it.
Yeah,
I don't think so. Yeah. I think that window has passed.
Yeah, I enjoyed that tone.
I loved that tone, and I thought Fede did a great job with that one.
I mean, like, yeah, I
it's a different, totally different world from the show.
As its own horror film, it's heavily rewatchable. I really like the Evil Dead.
See, but I like the Evil Dead remake, but I don't find it scary at all.
Really?
I don't think it's a scary movie.
I saw it intense.
Gory and cool.
It's gory and cool. And I think there's some good jump gags in it, but I mean, that's jump gags don't equate to scares. It's not scary.
I just think it'd be interesting because at the end, how he picks up Jane Levy, it'd be interesting to him play a serious version of Ash, and that while he's off doing a goofy. Yeah. It'd just be fun to see that different side to that character again. But
my only beef with the series is that they've kind of expanded this they've expanded the world a little bit where there's now these knights of whatever coming. I'm like, I like my Evil Dead universe a little bit more contained, and the rules very simple. But having this kind of long legacy of evil fighting knights, who have lived on, and I was like, okay, that's cool. But I'm enjoying the third season. I mean, I haven't gotten after the Spank Bank episode. I haven't seen the other ones after that. So I'm two weeks behind.
Yeah, three takes place the entire episode at a funeral, and it is a freaking riot.
Nice.
Nice.
I'll watch that tonight.
Do you think they're structuring it to possibly end with that in mind, or do you think they're thinking beyond?
No, I think they are, because season 2 ended in a way that was like, well, we're all wrapped
we're
up.
Done.
Just and that's why I was kind of like, I didn't have the urgency to start season 3. Because I'm like, well, there's no burning questions or I'm not that invested in this long story. It's just, again, it's popcorn entertainment.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But now that it started off, I think the daughter thing's really fun. And there's, again, a lot of great jokes and gags. And they had a giant mascot bear in the first episode or whatever. Yeah. So at least they keep introducing quirky things.
Yeah, the cast is good. They're really good at casting. I mean, the people that the girl that they got for Ash's daughter.
Yeah, she's great.
They're all good actors.
Yeah. So there you go. Ash vs. Evil Dead. Elric.
I saw a couple old quickies. I'd never seen the original Invaders from Mars. And I'll tell you why. This is a shameless plug. For the other show, we're going to do this crazy Carpenter retro thing. We're going to go film by film and pair everyone, and it's actually ballooning out to be quite long.
Mm-hmm.
Not surprisingly, the first 10 films is a 3-hour episode about to show. So obviously I was looking at basically every Mars film for Coast of Mars, and I ended up going totally a different road. But I'd never seen Invaders from Mars, and the thing is, it doesn't completely hold up as a movie, except for the kind of alien sequences, which are actually really surreal and really nicely shot. But I will say, man, and where kinder trauma is involved, this is one of those movies that had you been young when you saw this thing, it's so disturbing. Like
what
the
year?
Way they treat, is it 60s or early
53. 53.
The way they treat this little boy, like, you know, the father slaps him across the face because the father's changed into one of these things. The mother rejects him. Like, if you're aligned with this child in this film, it's actually terrible. I could see why people we know, like Larry Cohen and Tobe Hooper and these kind of directors, were really influenced by this film because it has just all those hallmarks. If you had seen it young, it would be truly quite, like, terrifying, I think. Much more so than, like, the big bug type movies. I think this one, especially because it's about replacing your family and something's changed, it's actually a really cool little movie. I dug it. The other thing I wanted just to remind people of, I showed it to a class yesterday. Man, Ed Wood is a perfect movie, and it's such a love letter to B-horror movies.
So good.
Like, beyond just the fact that it's a great comedy and it's a great, perfect movie, it's also just, like, so loving towards B-horror and, like, and Lugosi. And so, I don't know, I just watched it, and it was so fun to see people who'd never even really heard of it, because this is like, actually, I was thinking, somebody asked me how old is it, I was like, I had like 10 years or something. It's like 22 years.
Oh my
wow.
God.
Like, my brain just like melted when I heard that number. Yeah. So anyway, if you haven't seen it in a long time, or I just would highly recommend
it's
it.
My favorite, and probably Tim Burton's best.
Yeah,
it's my favorite.
It's
my favorite Burton film.
It's just coming from such a genuine place, and every decision along the way is kind of perfect. Mm-hmm. But also, just think about Lugosi, and think about some of our horror icons we lose, and how it's so fair. It shows all sides of it. It shows like the junkie, the desperate kind of suicidal guy, but also like somebody who had a real high point and real integrity. And I don't know, it's a great fucking movie. So that I just
handles,
wanted to
yeah, it handles it all really passionately. Like you don't leave thinking like Lugosi, what an asshole. Which you know. No. A lot of portrayals do. You leave it kind of like, he really liked what he was doing.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. And just the way a friend... actually, I'll tell you one thing that I thought was very interesting is it structurally, the disaster artist could be sued. Because if actually structurally, it's beat for beat, even towards the end, where the premiere happens and he gets up on stage, everything, it's a friendship movie.
Oh,
it's all about friendship.
When
I saw it in theaters, I was like, it's like Ed Wood. But when I watched Ed Wood again, I was like, oh my God. It's like they traced the outline for this movie.
Wow.
So anyway.
Also, a great score by Howard Shore.
It's one of, I think it's one of his
such
best.
Such a good
you know?
Score. Such a good score.
But anyway, super fun.
Yeah. I want to delve into a book.
Cool.
I just finished Head Full of Ghosts, Paul Tremblay's.
I love that book.
Holy crap, Elric.
I love that book so much.
You should have wrung my neck when you asked me, have you read this?
Oh, yeah.
Jesus Christ, this book is a roller coaster ride. If you guys don't know, it is about a family of four. You know, you got the parents, and then you've got a 14-year-old daughter, and you've got an 8-year-old little girl named Mary. And her sister Marjorie becomes possessed. And what do the parents do? They obviously take the church route and do their best to, you know, get rid of the spirit. But then what they do is they call a reality show team to come in and, you know, basically.
Circle what year again? When's it, like early 90s? Or is it?
It's supposed to be, no, I think it's late 90s.
Okay.
Early 90s or late 90s, but I think it's late 90s. They welcome a reality show producer to come in and bring his crew, and their exploits turn into a hit TV show called The Possession. Mm-hmm. And Tremblay's focus is, the story is told from the point of view of the 8-year-old little girl, past and then present, and then
and she's a blogger now of a
well, that's a little twisty thing, but it's past and present, and then you kind of get little drops of information about the TV show itself and some significant points through this blog that's run by a girl who is a horror movie fan, a horror movie blogger, writes for Fangoria magazine, and has deadlines and does all these things.
But under an alias, so people don't realize
alias,
she actually was the one who was there, present.
Yeah. And it's and it takes an incredibly sad and dark turn. It is phenomenal, this book.
You know, it's interesting.
Really
when
scary
I saw,
stuff.
Because I had read it before we saw the Exorcist series.
Yeah.
When I saw the first season, I was watching going, I wonder if they read that book, because the relationship of the two girls was very similar.
And even the way it was portrayed, I was like, that's kind of how
I imagined that book. So who knows? It could be probably coincidental. But
well, I think the first season comes from a few things.
Of course.
It's a really, really
great
book.
It's a great read.
And I cannot wait, because Robert Downey Jr.'s company picked it up for a film, and Osgood Perkins is writing and directing the script.
Oh, nice. nice.
Some friends of ours who had written a previous draft of that, that is now no longer writing it, but that's all right. I won't reveal that. You never know how these things go. But yeah, I do think he's an interesting fit for it, because the hard part is like, I guess the hard part is like that the parts we like in the book, which are like the videotaping stuff, that part's so integral. You like on film now, post-paranormal, it's a little trickier,
I think. I'm going to be very curious as to how he pulls off the kind of like postmodern stuff and the blog stuff. But yeah, it's just a really terrifying book and a very interesting spin on the possession / exorcism subgenre.
Somebody just read, I think it might have been Dick, just read whatever his latest book is, the one that just came out, and said it's equally good. He said it was even scarier. Yeah.
Wow.
Even, so I have to look that up.
That's cool.
Very cool.
But next to my docket, I can't wait to
read. Hex?
Is no, not
God
yet.
God damn it, Turek.
I want to read that one.
Hex
I heard good things
is
about Hex.
So good. That's another one. Why have you not read this, Turek?
I want to balance it with some nonfiction, and I'm now going to read Nothing Wrong Here, The Making of Cujo.
Oh, cool.
So, oh, wow.
Nice. Okay, fine. Then Hex.
What if I
do
both?
Well, I'll do a book as well, because I had some crazy, crazy action this past weekend and ended up in the hospital
for
a stress.
Your real-life horror story.
Yeah, real-life horror story. Hey, guys, apparently I'm very likely allergic to fish now. Who knew that until my face was swelling? Anywho, so I'm sitting in the hospital for 8 hours while they monitor me to make sure my throat doesn't start swelling again. And literally only had my cell phone and I was bored to tears, because by that time I was recovering. And so I actually read an entire series that was sent to us by a listener. Oh. His name, and I hope I said, Gerardo Presidio. And the art was by Abraham Catassi. I hope I'm saying that right. And it's a Spanish graphic novel called Sicario. And it was just awesome. It's badass gangsters, but it gets really surreal in it. It was really brutal. You can actually, the whole series is free online.
I'm looking at your notes, but it's not Sicario.
Sicario.
Like P-S-Y.
Yeah.
Not Sicario, the film.
Sicario. and you can actually find the series, the bulk of it, online through Old Skull Comics. Like it's posted like a blog, which I just thought was awesome because I read the whole thing. Pardon me, I read it on my phone because I was in an emergency room.
Not even the big screen.
I know, guys. The cinema, the graphic novel equivalent of Elric Cinema Police.
Yeah,
they're grinding their teeth at me right now.
That's how I read comic books on my iPad.
But no, it was great because I literally read it while I was sitting there on a lot of drugs, and it was just a refreshing read. Sweet, so I highly recommend just Googling Old Skull Comics, and again, a listener sent it to me, so thank you for listening as well, and really good work on the comic.
Nice.
Very cool. I got a few things from Scream Factory that I wanted to mention. Not so much the films, but because I've seen both of these a lot, but they just put out The Burbs, Tom Hanks, Joe
Dante. Comedy of all time.
One of the greatest comedies of all time. And this release, Brand New Scan, it's got some new interviews, but really the gold is a feature-length documentary called There Goes the Neighborhood, which also appeared on the Hour release. This was done by Callum Waddell, who's done quite a lot and been a horror writer for a long time. But basically, it's a really great documentary just about the making of The Burbs, kind of how it came about, the time period that it came out, kind of being a little ahead of the curve. Corey Feldman saying some very Corey Feldman things in the documentary, which is amazing.
Does he talk about Dick Miller?
No, but I'm going to bring that story up in a second. So this is a good disc. I mean, obviously, if you love The Burbs, it's definitely worth upgrading. And they do some new interviews with Joe Dante, which are good but kind of repetitive if you watch the feature-length documentary at this point. Yeah. But I understand it's like, oh, let's get some new stuff in it. But there's only so many ways that Joe Dante is going to talk about The Burbs, so there isn't anything really that new in his new interview. But I still really loved it. And the one thing I wish was on here, which I don't even know if Elric probably knows what I'm talking about, which I don't know if I'm allowed to talk about it, but basically, before I even lived here, over 10 years ago, our friend Mike Williamson had shown The Burbs in his backyard. He has a 16mm print. He did screenings in his backyard. He actually served, pretzels and sardines or whatever the gimmick is. And I believe at that point, there was no plans for a special edition or anything. And so the editor from the film came over.
He came to Jump Cut and
And he brought a blooper reel. The blooper reel will never get released because everyone on the blooper reel has to sign off on it. And I don't think Tom Hanks would ever sign off on the bloopers. But it features the greatest schooling I've ever seen in my life, which basically is Dick Miller is about to shoot a scene. Corey Feldman is bouncing up and down like a madman. Yeah. And literally out of nowhere, Miller says, "All right, shut the fuck up, kid. We're going to do a little acting here." And like, it's the great, one of the greatest bloopers
I've ever. That has to be a t-shirt, right?
Oh my God.
Actually, no, you know what? They used it in the Dick Miller documentary.
Yeah, that's the idea.
Okay, all right.
Because when Elijah was on YouTube.
I'm sorry. Yeah. It does exist. It's in the Dick Miller, that guy, Dick Miller.
The actual clip? Yeah.
That clip that I just said,
so that means
yes.
Feldman signed off on it.
Maybe not. Maybe he doesn't know that it's in that documentary. Yeah, but it is one of my favorite things ever, and I'm glad you reminded me. It did surface. And the other thing they put out also was Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon, which is now 10 years old, which is kind of insane that it's been a decade since that movie came out. If you have not seen it, it's really, really great. It is both kind of a docudrama slash slasher film that kind of breaks down the rules of all the slashers that grew up in the 80s while simultaneously going back and forth into an actual slasher movie. And it's just really great. And it's finally gotten – there was a Anchor Bay Blu-ray of it that just had the movie, and it was not a new transfer. Finally, Scream Factory's done it right. It's a brand new scan of it. They carted over all the special features again, and there's a bunch of new ones as well, including a little documentary that was shot at Dark Delicacies here in Burbank. They were doing a little signing for, I think, the comic book. Mm-hmm. There's also a feature on the comic book. Ryan, I bought you the comic. I keep forgetting to bring it every week.
No worries.
They had done a comic book that was a crowdfunding project to – basically, they had so much trouble making the sequel that they were like, screw it. Let's just take the sequel script and tell that story in comic book form. Mm. So people could get to, you know, experience that story. And if we get to make the movie, it's still going to be different because it's a different medium and you kind of like update it. So I think the first 4 of 6 issues have come out and it's really cool. It's very unexpected. And it's because the satirical, not satirical, I don't know if that's the right word, but the way that it approaches the first movie, the way the sequel, I had no idea how the sequel would do it, but it's very underlining where it's like, what if you plan this great this great slasher, like, you know, murdering spree, and you're convinced you're going to be the next big thing, but you're not. You have a few cult followers, people dig it, but you didn't become the next big thing. What did you do wrong? How do you plan your comeback? And so the sequel story is exactly that, which is literally the filmmakers very much saying, like, why didn't our movie get more people to like it? And this and that is like, how do we get people, like, how do we get Leslie back? And so he kind of comes back because they're making a movie about the story. And, you know, so it's a lot of fun. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
And you can circle back and listen to our one of our Stranger Killer POV episodes.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
With the actor.
Nathan Basil and AJ Bowen back on Killer POV. Yeah. Well, I don't know if you can listen to it at this point since the Geek Nation shows are down, but they're floating around there. So
yes, I have seen
it's now a cool
versions.
Underground thing. Much edgier.
I'm looking forward to revisiting Behind a Mask. I haven't seen it in
it's really cool.
9 years.
And then I think you'll enjoy the comic books as well. Yeah. Although I only got you the first 3 and the 4 just came out. I think they read better in a row.
Yeah.
Like, I've been getting them as they've been coming out, but like, I sat down, I just read the first 4 and I'm like, oh, now I see what the story is. And it's really cool. Huh. Anything else?
No, that's me caught up this week.
You know, I watched Anthropophagus.
Oh my God, that's so weird because I'm going to be talking about that. That's amazing that you just watched. I'd never seen it before.
You really? Uh-huh, oh my gosh. So mine was somebody had stuck for horror trivia when we do horror trivia each month. People will just shove DVDs in there for us to give away. Like, you know, I'm purging some DVDs. I'll just stick, you know, whatever ones I'm getting rid of in there so we could pass them out as surprising. And somebody had stuck in like the entire D'Amato collection of his weird porn horror
crossovers.
Yeah, I saw those
weird DVDs in there, Porno Holocaust.
You know, I had tried to watch these in past, and they are neither sexy nor scary. Yeah. They're just kind of is the only way I can describe them. Some of them have really cool soundtracks, but I can only describe the movies as neither scary nor porny. So, I mean, that's about it. And so, when I saw those in there, I was like, you know what? I'm going to try this again. So I watched like the first 15 minutes of Porno Holocaust, and then I made it like 20 minutes into Images of a Convent, which I was like, it's nuns. I have to see this. And again, I was just left with the neither sexy nor scary. I'm kind of done. And then I was like, you know what? I want to watch good D'Amato, if there is such a thing. So that I was like,
there's D'Amato with great scenes.
That's it.
And like, so then, great sequences, but
after,
not necessarily
great films. My short you know, tiny experiences of porno holocausts and images of a convent, I decided to watch Anthropophagus, which feels like...
I'm impressed you can say it because I kept going, Anthropophagus.
It's got like an extra syllable in there that I tend to leave out. Anthropophagus?
Because it's pop and then haggis.
Pop haggis.
But I don't know how you're to say it.
The Phagus.
You could just call it Grim Reaper.
So, Grim Reaper. So, I will say this falls into line with a lot of D'Amato, where it has good scenes. Most of it feels like a travel log of Greek islands while these people kind of pilot around Greek islands. And then some cool murders happen. And then there's a great scene at the end.
Couple great sequences, man. Yeah. I think there's a few. But what's really fucking cool about this movie, the score is fucking great.
Yeah.
And it has one of the best trailers I've ever seen.
That's the last thing. Great soundtrack.
Like, just trust me, just go straight to the trailer and you'll be like, this looks like the greatest, because there's no dialogue in the trailer. It's just the music and the crazy gory shit. But yes, there is a lot of waiting in between. But yes, this is a movie that I actually am pairing with a Carpenter movie, so I'm not going to tell which one.
Wow.
And so it's just amazing that you said it now, because I just watched it on YouTube this
you
week
watched
for the first
it on
time.
YouTube?
Yeah, because there's no other way to watch it.
Cinepolis, I have DVD.
This is an out-of-print film. I looked it up.
Cinepolis are so coming for you now.
It was a pretty shitty copy, too.
Did you watch it?
And I did not watch The Grim Reaper, because The Grim Reaper is heavily cut.
Yeah. I have the Anthropophagus DVD that came out. I think it was Blue Underground. A couple of maybe a decade ago.
Yeah, I think there's a foreign blue, and it's but it's a bummer. But no, you know what? I thought it was really cool. I thought that like the couple parts that push the gore, I was like, holy shit! But there is a lot of waiting around for shit to happen. And
it's a lot of just
Mia Farrow's sister's the lead.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
totally bizarre.
Wow. It's a lot of boat imagery and then some crazy gore.
Yeah,
but that
I'm all down for boat imagery.
Especially Greek Isles, right?
Compared to Porno Holocaust, this feels like an Oscar winner.
Porno Holocaust, I admit watching by myself, and there is some dirty ass shit in that movie.
Oh my god, that's
there's some gnarly
one DVD cover to it that's a little too much.
Yeah, it's too much, man.
Is it the blowjob cover?
It's with the like zombie like holding the head of the girl.
And it's like a big black bar across it. There's some gnarly pubes.
Great soundtrack, though.
Great soundtrack.
Yeah, and no, same with Blue Omega. Like that has the goblin. No, he's good with his soundtrack.
No, the soundtrack is amazing, but yeah, I still can't figure those out. And I also watched.
I know what it was like on set of Porno Holocaust.
Oh my god! So you're gonna put the zombie makeup on, and then
can you shave the pubes a little bit?
But I've even tried. He has Papaya Love Goddess one I watched, and again, it's great soundtrack. And then there's some of his Emmanuel ones that definitely drift into the porny realm.
They're being re-released, right? One of his Emmanuels.
I think they have a box. At least one of them,
like the cannibal one, Emmanuel.
I think that Severin's doing it.
That actually looks pretty cool.
Yeah.
That one, but.
Wow.
D'Amato.
Yeah, what a coincidence. Well, that is actually a huge coincidence. I'm not even kidding. Like, I watched it this week and you watched that. That's pretty bizarre.
I like the films that D'Amato produced much, much later. Man. Things like Witchery, things like that.
Oh, you like those kind of ones?
Yeah, some of his his directorial ones. Yeah. I like Anthropophagus.
All right.
What a way to go out. Yeah, and I will also say, just because one of our listeners had been messaging us about it on Facebook, I've been watching Wild Wild Country on Netflix, the documentary. It's crazy. It's like a Keepers level of engaging.
Cool.
I can't exactly call it horror, but if you're into horror, it's about the formation of a cult, them moving into a small Oregon town, and then discovering the corruption and how they're recruiting members. And so it definitely has these kind of like horror psychology overtones to it.
And Mark Duplass, the guy is a creep character in it, right?
Totally. Yeah, Duplass shows up with the cell phone.
He just passes through the
peach,
background.
The peach fuzz.
He films it. That would be great. He's the documentarian.
He's wearing the peach fuzz mask.
But
it's Duplass produced, I think, or something.
It's Duplass produced.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah, their names are all over the opening credits.
It looks really cool.
It's definitely like I made it. And like The Keepers, it's one where I can't exactly binge watch because there's so much to absorb in it.
Is it six episodes?
Yeah, I'm two episodes in, and I'm like itching to go home and watch some more of it tonight. So.
Oh, and I just for the record, I will see Inside Number 9 next week something. I promise. The guy watched Possession and it changed his world. So I'm ready to do this.
Oh, it's your turn.
It's my turn. I take the challenge. Right.
The people who run the Inside Number 9 Twitter are giving Elric so much shit now.
I will let Becca choose my first episode. Becca, you can write to me. Tell me what you think the first one I should try.
Okay, I'm making a note here. They're only like 25 minutes long, so I'm going to send you
I'll try to watch like three before next week.
Seriously, you could watch the whole season.
I like that we're already getting a sneak preview of what we're going to be talking about next week.
Yeah. But you, so you can tell me offline. You know, it doesn't have to be live on air
during the show.
I'm incredibly excited because Santa Clarita Diet comes back this week. Which was like,
I liked that show.
It was like fresh air for me. It was just fun. There was nothing.
Ryan's so critical of Timothy Oliphant's acting in that film.
Was that the?
I liked him in that. I thought he was funny.
I thought he was funny in it.
Unfortunately, we're doing this on video, so you're seeing my face.
Like, oh. Elephant's watching right now going, oh yeah.
He's like,
never coming.
And that fucker who's got my hair, too. He's got the elephant hair.
Did anybody watch Tabula Rosa?
No. I got your text at midnight last night.
Dude, why aren't you up watching shit with me at midnight?
Because
One of our listeners is one of the directors.
I want to watch it. It looks really
good. We should watch it for next week.
Yeah.
I have a few things to touch on before we wrap up. I want to give a shout out to Umbrella, the Australian company that's been doing these Blu-rays, because hot on the heels of last week's episode, they literally just announced they're doing Reanimator and a double feature Blu-ray of Bride of and Beyond Reanimator.
What?
So it is the only way you'll be able to get the third Reanimator on Blu-ray. And not only that, but all of these Umbrella titles are all region. And so you can order them. They will play fine on your player. Following up on Ryan's review of Silver Bullet, I went home and bought their Silver Bullet Blu-ray. And I bought Silver Bullet and Orca, the Killer Whale.
Oh. Damn right you did.
Yeah, because I'm like, well, I got to get them both, right? Yeah. They're both from Umbrella. The only thing I wanted to mention about Silver Bullet, which I do love, I've always loved it, is there is a great interview with Everett McGill on there, who played the priest. Mm-hmm. And the biggest revelation I had is he kind of got guilted into doing the movie. But not only that, he's actually in the werewolf costume for every shot that you see.
Oh, that's cool.
Because, so the werewolf, because this is a Dino De Laurentiis movie, okay? And Dino had gotten Carlos Rambaldi to do the werewolf, and it didn't look good at all. It was terrible. Which, considering when this came out, he should have known better, because he also did Dino De Laurentiis' 1976 King Kong, which, by the way, didn't look good and it didn't work. And so Rick Baker had to put on a gorilla suit and play King Kong in that.
And quick possession fact, when Zulowski went to pick up Carlo Rambaldi's design thing, he had no idea it was going to be a giant penis monster. In fact, that wasn't that wasn't part of the plan for this movie at all. And he opened it, he was like, what the fuck is this? And he
Rambaldi.
Had no choice.
There's
that was from
Rambaldi.
Did I hear that he used that, like, Rambaldi kind of recycled the monster for Cameron's Closet?
There's a rumor about that.
Yeah.
But basically, so what happened was, I think Everett McGill had done something for the Laurentiis's, another film or something, felt indebted to them, and they said to him, they're like, look, this werewolf looks terrible, but Rambaldi already did it. And we feel if we put a real actor in there, it'll help sell it more.
Oh,
and so he's like, I can't do that. I'll play the priest, but I don't want to be in the suit. And basically he's like, so I'm in the freaking suit days. They convinced me to do it because they thought my movements as a real actor would be better.
Well, it's funny that they say that because a lot of it's all eyes.
Yeah.
It's just a lot of close-up coverage of eyes.
That's so how they got around that.
Yeah.
However, the transformations were done by Matt Mungle and one of the other well-known. And that stuff's actually pretty good. The transformation stuff in that. But anyway, Umbrella's Silver Bullet's great. And Orca the Killer Whale, which I'd never seen from 1977. This Blu-ray is terrific. It kind of falls in that, post-Jaws ripoff kind of thing. But it's actually way more fucked up.
There's
the baby orca stuff that's really messed
there's
up.
There's some gnarly stuff at the beginning. It is basically a killer whale. That's all you need to know. Yeah. And again, it's another Dino De Laurentiis production. And so basically they're like, what's more fierce than a great white? And they're like, well, the killer whale. Is like, great, fuck Jaws, we're gonna make a killer whale movie. I will say it looks great though. I could never tell between there's real whale footage and then, like, I guess a giant plastic one, but I never could tell. It looked freaking great to me. Richard Harris, Charlotte Rampling's great in it.
Bo Derek.
I mean,
it also feels like a
Robert
real movie,
Carradine.
Right? Like, it feels like it's almost Oscar kind of movie, but then also exploitation. So it's like weirdly stuck between
those
two.
It's got that weird vibe to it. Yeah.
So, exploitation.
Yeah.
I strongly recommend those from Umbrella. And last but not least, I revisited the original Death Wish after the remake, since we brought it last week. Yes, that movie is unremakeable. There is some, they not even the sequels can capture what that first Death Wish is. Because I watched Death Wish 2 and that goes way too far.
Yeah, way too far.
And I don't like that movie at all.
Well, there's a lot I like about the way it's made, but man, the content
of it's pretty ugly.
It's pretty gnarly, but there's something about that first one that I watched. I'm like, yeah, this is it. You can't ever capture this again.
Even just him like doing the thing with his finger at the end, it's just brilliant. It's
that
like,
last
that's
shot
need,
is one of the greatest shots, and the Bruce Willis version is just as asleep as his performance.
Can't do it.
Well, I did want to throw in that we haven't talked about this in a while is that for you listeners, your ratings on iTunes and your feedback fuel us and fuel our popularity on iTunes. And so if you rate us and give us a high rating, you know, we'll pop up easier in search functions for those who have never heard the show or discovered the show. So don't forget to leave us some feedback on iTunes. Don't forget to, you know, add us on Facebook and talk about it with your friends. That stuff is, we haven't really kind of reminded you in a while. So that was just my little ding ding.
We're nominated for a Rondo Award.
Hey, that too.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. We're up against like 20 things, right?
Yeah.
So it's going to take real loyalty for us to pull this out.
Sure.
So please, go to the Rondo Awards website. There's details on how to vote. It's you have to email your ballot in. Yeah. But that said, you can make it simple. You can just email, hey, multimedia website is the category we're nominated in, and then just put Shockwaves.
Sure.
And that's all you got to do. And hopefully that'll...
But you also have to write an essay about what multimedia is to them.
No, that's
I don't know.
That's not true at all.
But we'll take it.
All right. We'll be back in a bit.
This week's episode of Shockwaves is brought to you by the Tom Savini Special Effects Makeup Program and the George A. Romero Filmmaking Program. Both are part of the Douglas Education Center in Manesson, Pennsylvania. Perhaps there is no program in the world more defined by the people inside it or by the spirit, energy, and imagination that they embody. Join the thousands of students from all over the world who have embarked on the journey that is Tom Savini Special Effects Makeup Program. Let us help you hone your skills as we teach you how to bring your drawings to life and nightmares to reality. And at George A. Romero's filmmaking program, your experience goes far beyond filmmaking. You have the opportunity to work alongside special effect makeup artists to bring your characters and films to life. You are the storyteller. You have a passionate message to tell, and you are the one who brings our greatest fears, our greatest hopes, and our greatest loves to reality. For more information on the Tom Savini Special Effects Makeup Program and the George A. Romero Filmmaking Program, for more information on the Tom Savini Special Makeup Effects Program and the George A. Romero Filmmaking Program, please visit the Douglas Education Center website at www.dec.edu. Hashtag make monsters and hashtag make movies. And I'll also say that a couple of years ago, I actually had the opportunity to go there. They invited me out. I got to go visit the Douglas Education Center. They have some freaking crazy awesome facilities. Like, it was amazing. Like, just great equipment, great students, great teachers. It was a wonderful trip.
The Shockwaves team is heading to Texas Frightmare this May, and we hope to see you all there. Texas Frightmare is the Southwest's premier horror convention and is now celebrating their 13th year. They always have the best guests, the best panels, and you don't want to miss it. Texas Frightmare will be showing a sneak preview of Arrow's upcoming restored Last House on the Left release, and they will have cast members Jeremy Rain and Mark Scheffler. Other guests include Clive Barker, several of the Cenobites, including Doug Bradley, all the kids from the It Losers Club, Tobin Bell, Shawnee Smith, Ron Perlman, Charlie Band, Brad Dourif, Katie Featherstone, and many more. Head to www.texasfrightmareweekend.com and get your tickets now. We will all be there with our own booth. We're going to have our own panel on Sunday.
We're going to have some horror trivia.
We're going to have some horror trivia.
We're going to be hosting panels.
And Elric wants you to touch his face.
Yeah, I do.
Purposely that was so demure you said
he
that.
He didn't, though.
Touch my face.
I'll do one more. And the Shockwaves team is going to be, well, 3 out of 4, and that's not bad. It's going to be in Chattanooga for the film festival. We are really psyched. We're also hearing like a lot of friends and other podcasts. It just seems like a lot of cool people are going to be there for this period, a lot of filmmakers, a lot of great cinema. I think this is going to be a really good time. If you haven't got a pass yet, you should go check it out. I know there's still passes available, and it's like, you know, 4 or 5 days of barbecue and cinema. What could go wrong?
I know. And they're showing some amazing films there, not just mine. There's a lot of other really good
stuff. There's an Estonian movie
well.
I'm dying to see.
I can't wait to
People
see.
People tell me it's great.
The Ranger looks really good, so I'm psyched to check out a lot of stuff. So, yeah, it's going to be fun.
I'd like to welcome a special guest who has become a friend over the last year, Mr. Jonah Ray.
Hey. That's like the best intro I've ever gotten.
Really?
That was so nice.
And it was like a sentence long.
It was very personal.
I know. It was very quick. But I want to say is that you were very kind. And I think I reached out to you after the fact. But, we did Slashback Video last year. And I saw a really stellar video come out of it on Instagram that was like a cool, hip music video with some girl and stuff. And I was like, who's this guy that made this rad video about Slashback Video? Because that's awesome. And then I was like, okay, cool. And then Blum comes in to the office and he's like, guys, we're making three movies with Chris Hardwick. And I was like, hold on, wait, what? And I listened to the Nerdist podcast that Jonah's a part of. And I'm listening to the Blum episode. And I'm listening to the trajectory of the conversation to Blum suddenly making a deal with Chris on air. And then Jonah not only drops Shockwaves, but Slashback Video all in one sentence.
Wow.
And
thank
I was
you.
Like,
smokes.
Okay, I need to know who
this is. My favorite guest already.
So you actually listened to us before you came on the show?
Yeah, of course.
Holy smokes. Yeah.
So thank you for that. And then I was just like, hey, you want to be friends? And he was like, yeah, let's hang out.
That moment was, and I love Chris. He was one of my best friends, but it really felt like that moment in the Radioactive Man Simpsons episode where it's like, you should direct a horror movie. I'm sorry, you right there. Yeah. So I felt like, I was like, wait, but I know these things. You can't. This guy, he hosts a show with Dick Pachinko.
Just turn things upside down.
So, Ryan, tell our audience what Jonah is known for, besides being the star of Victor Crowley.
So, obviously, I mean, like, I had listened to Jonah for quite a long time on the Nerdist podcast, and also Mystery Science Theater.
Yeah, that's
you're the new guy.
Yeah, I'm one of I might be the Chris Eccleston of Mystery Science Theater House. We'll see how long I last, but
hopefully it doesn't end like his Doctor Who.
Hopefully I'll be able to get invited back when they have all three of us or four or five or whatever happens.
Well, I want to say we're catching you as you're preparing for season two.
We're writing it right now.
That's
awesome.
Yeah, and it's not fun. It sounds fun. I'm sure we all thought it was fun when we were watching it a long time ago.
Yeah.
And then it turns out the whole concept of the show of being tortured by having to watch bad movies is how it's made.
I listened to interviews with like Mike and Joel from the original incarnations of the show, and they talked about how they would literally have just crates of movies that they would have to watch, and then they would go like, oh, I can't find anything good in this one. Is that what this is like now?
Luckily for me, where I'm at as just a I'm a lower end producer and then the star and the writer on it. And so the movies are just brought to us. I don't have to kind of go through. I suggested a ton of movies for this next season, all of which were denied. I was campaigning really hard for Maximum Overdrive.
Yes!
Can I make a cameo?
Wait, how about we all get together
and
just do a commentary for all four of us? We'll do it as a Shockwave special.
Yeah.
That would be fun.
Because that's
a bonkers
because it's. I thought, I was trying to tell him, I was like, we're in the middle of Stephen King renaissance. So it's like to do like his thing, and then we can have, I was like, and then we can try and get, Matthew Holness, who played Garth Marenghi, to make an appearance.
I was trying to pour in
all these different things that I liked, and then they said, just too expensive. Because that's the other thing. It's, they have to, for as many episodes as they have, and how they want, like Netflix is like, we want some big name stuff. And so all of a sudden, you spend more money on one movie, and then you have to get a couple other movies that are a little cheaper to make up that difference.
From the first season, what would be the bigger movie, that more expensive?
I'm trying to think of Star Crash, I think, was high up on that scale.
Did they do public domain stuff?
None of it was public domain. I think because they got a deal, Shout did a deal through, I think, MGM.
Okay.
One of those places that has a ton of stuff. And this time, Netflix was saying that they wanted higher profile stuff. And that's a good idea. But of course, that reactionary punk rock thing is like, no, we should go even further into the depths. Yeah. And I was, I was pitching the movie Getaven.
Okay.
Another one.
Getaven is a movie, I'm not sure who found it. It might have been Dimitri and Suki from Everything is Terrible. But they found this movie that this guy John DeHart made He's a trial attorney in Los Angeles, and he wrote, directed, starred.
Always a good idea.
Made a couple songs, directed his own sex scenes with these like, Playboy models.
Yes.
And Tommy style.
It's just so terrible, terrible, terrible.
Yeah.
And like I showed it to the Chef Factory guys, and they're like, it's too bad.
Yeah.
It's just too bad, and it's kind of a bummer.
Huh. Interesting. Well, I'm curious. I mean, like, for you to take on this starring role in a series that I was just explaining to some of our assistants here at the office, you know, that was the lifeblood of my college years, was going home, watching, you know, Mystery Science Theater each week and having a blast with friends.
Yeah.
And it was kind of, it was like, in this weird limbo, because it was stuff that I had grown up with myself because my father introduced it to me, and stuff that I had never seen before. Yeah. So it was kind of like, oh, guys, shut. I was like, Crow, shut the fuck up. I want to watch this movie for a second. Yeah. I wanted everybody to just be quiet. And then I would go and revisit those films without the MST3K kind of vibe to it.
Yeah.
But for you, I mean, was it part of your formative years of discovery and loving the genre? And
well, when Comedy Central started being on TV in Hawaii, it was a little later because we were seeing – that's the thing that happens in Hawaii. Like, well, you'll see commercials for stuff way before it ever gets there. We were seeing commercials for like, you know, different fast food places. Like, I saw Wendy's commercials all the time. There's no Wendy's on Oahu, you know. but I was always fascinated by the square patties. But Comedy Central, when like it's like I was obsessed with comedy and movies, and the fact that there was a Comedy Central, and when it started, you know, I was watching everything on it. And then one day I turned it on, and I just saw an old movie, and I was like, oh, they're doing that thing that, you know, channels do, or they just show an old movie that's dumb, and then. And then I heard voices talking over the movie, and I thought that two channels had been layered on top of each other, and there was something wrong with the cable box. And then I saw the silhouettes. And then luckily, they walked out and did a segment on The Cell I Love. And I was, you know, I remember recognizing Joel from like some reruns of Letterman show when he was on there and old SNL episodes. And so I just became obsessed with it because it was right around the time that it was all these different things in my life. I was getting into like old sci-fi movies and old movies in general and just trying to, you know, educate myself about that kind of stuff. And I was getting really into comedy, and I was also really into punk rock, like getting into punk rock and DIY ideas. And so like this show kind of represented all those things for me, where it's just these guys in Minneapolis like putting on a show and knowing about movies and like these references and stuff like that. So I was obsessed with it, and it really was my favorite show, and never thinking that this I would end up being the guy, which was also scary as a person. You know, it was gone by the time I started my career, and then I'm working my way towards trying, you know, making stuff, making TV, making my own stories, like, you know, working on trying to make my own movies and my own TV shows. And then this gets offered to me, and I was like, of course. And then I turned to my wife, I was like, wait, is this a good idea? Like, it's like, imagine if, like, you know, I do a few seasons of this thing, and then I go and I try to make a movie, and then, you know, I could just see the headline. It's like, so the guy who makes fun of movies thought he could do it himself. Not so easy, is it, asshole?
Yeah.
And so it's been really fun to do, and it's really, really great and mind-blowing, but it's also, I'm still scared all the time.
It's
but that's
work.
All, you know, aren't we all?
Yeah. It's work. I mean, like, what were there any particular older episodes, pre your time, obviously, that you were especially fond of? Because, I mean, everybody could point to Manos, the Hands of Fate is a classic episode, you know? Was there any particular one that just struck you as...
Ego is one of my all-time favorites. Hot People is the one I probably... And it's also one of those things where it's one of the ones, like, that's the one I had the VHS of, you know? Yeah. So it's... and This Island Earth, which was the Mystery Science Theater movie. The ones I saw over and over again, I was able to see over and over again, were the ones that became my favorites. And, you know, there's still some I haven't seen just because we were all at the mercy of, you know, I couldn't afford to buy every box set that came out.
Right.
And so we were at the mercy of whatever, which ones we caught on TV. And I tried to tape them as much as I could, but there's a lot of tapes, you know? There's a lot of Simpsons I got to record,
too. Didn't have that many tapes in Hawaii.
Yeah, exactly. They didn't come yet. We heard about these extended play.
Black boxes?
Yeah.
What was the Joe Don Baker one?
Mitchell.
Mitchell's great. Mitchell's my favorite.
Diabolic or Diabolique.
That's
really good.
That's a great movie, though. I think that's a quality movie.
And some people that don't like the idea of riffing over movies, and they'll always have a few different ways to attack it. They go, well, I can do that myself. I don't need these jerks to do it for me. It's promoting talking over movies.
That's actually, you're bringing up an interesting topic, because when they brought back MST3K, I was like, oh, that's really weird because we're living in this time in which you go to the New Beverly and it's like, you know, turn your phones off and don't, you know, shut the fuck up. And but we're living in this very tight-knit community where, you know, the theatrical experience is a holy experience. And don't ruin that. I mean, I remember the early days of going to New Beverly and riffing with everybody else because we were all having fun.
Yeah.
And, you know,
I'm glad I wasn't here for those days.
You would have had a
and
blast.
Actually, you know what's funny is they always said, like, this isn't Mystery Science Theater here at the New Beverly.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
like,
yeah,
that's the reference.
But the difference is you're choosing this experience.
Yeah.
When you go to New Beverly, you can't shut this people out. And these guys are trained in comedy. He's been professionally trained.
Yeah.
He has a certificate.
Working for years.
And being funny.
But did you get pushback from any friends who were kind of against that, the whole notion of
The only real like weird things that happened with it were I went with a friend to go see it, and he's like a guy that I know just from he's in bands, and so he, you know, he doesn't have that self-conscious thing that a lot of comics have where it's like I'm not going to be like the jokey guy in public all the time, and you know, he's just a guy that's used to like goofing off with his friends, and we sat down, we start watching it, and he's just like cracking jokes, and I was like, you can't do that, people will see that it's me. and they'll be so like, it's like, oh, this motherfucker thinks he can do this stuff. And then I went to go see the triple feature, the Egyptian, a few weeks ago, of Brain Damage, Basket Case.
Oh, I was so close to pulling that. I'd seen all of them so recently, but I really wanted to. Was he there or was he on Skype?
He was not there at all.
Oh, okay.
He didn't show up. The guy who did the effects was there, and they had the I can't remember his name.
Elmer.
Elmer in the lobby.
Oh, that's cool.
And that was great. It was one of those things, like any triple feature I've ever been to, it's like the second one ends, I'm like, I don't think I can do the third one. But those movies are just, they trot along so well.
Oh, yeah.
Third one Frankenhooker?
Yes, the third one was Frankenhooker.
It's hard not to, that's my favorite.
Yeah, so it is so fun. Great. And what a weird performance.
Shared universe. Yeah.
The shared universe, exactly. But I went to that, and I sat down on the balcony, and some guy sat, it was getting in front of me, and then he does a double take. He's like, uh-oh, here we go. I'm off the clock, man.
That's funny.
It would be even worse if you just took out two of the little the robot action figures, put them up, put them up on the balcony. My two friends are here.
Yeah. This is all I have. But you know, it's still just this past weekend. I'm not sure if you guys have had him on the show, Rob Schraub.
We love Rob. Yeah, he came on our live show for Sharksploitation.
Our lowest listened to show.
We need to have Rob back on.
I know, for a proper episode.
He's great. Yeah. But we went over to his place and we did some schlocking and we watched a movie that I saw once as a kid and couldn't ever find or figure out what it was for decades.
Oh, what are the clues? Before telling us the title, what were the things you remembered that you were searching?
Let's see if we can figure it out.
All right, so there's, I just remember two guys on a bus, and then I thought they get kicked out of the bus, and then they're like, what are we going to do? And then a lady goes, there is Santana. And they're like, what? Where'd you come from? There is Santana. And the butcher was like, you don't want to go to Santana. And they're like, oh, it's only right there. Let's go. And so they go to this town, and the whole town seems to be packing up. And it turns out that one day a year is the day that hell visits this town.
Oh, shit.
Oh, this sounds familiar.
The Santana thing is starting to
I don't know what it is.
It's called Judgment Day.
Oh.
And it also has a subtitle like Legend of the Third Hand or something like that. But Cesar Romero.
In case Judgment Day wasn't good enough.
Yeah. But it was one of those things where it got to a point where I've explained that same stuff to a ton of people over the years. No one knew what I was talking about. I would say, you know, Judgment Day or Judgment Night. They're like, well, Judgment Night with Emilio Estevez? No. And then I would say, yeah, and then there's this devil guy, and he opens up his arms, and then another hand comes out.
Oh, cool. Cool picture.
Yeah. That's trippy. Is.
Yeah.
What?
Because I know there's sites now that try to help people with this.
I remember the VHS cover of this.
Yes, and that's what it was. That's why we rented it. And I could never find it again, never could figure out how to look it up. And then from talking about it a few times over the years on the Nerdist podcast, and just from, you know, I follow a ton of VHS collectors on Instagram. You know, this guy messaged me. He said, hey, I have two copies of this if you want me to send it to you.
Wow.
And I was, yes, here's my address. And then when it showed up, I got excited, showed it to my wife. She's all, you gave someone on the internet our address?
Now, is that one you can turn into
an episode?
That's a good
reaction.
No? Too hard. Would it be too hard to get the rights?
I asked, and it's like, that's one of those lost, it never made it to DVD, you know.
I never even heard of this one.
Are those hard to get the rights to? I assume if it's like
if
something
it's lost
that's
chain of
yeah,
title
lost
and
chain of title. Like, how would you even start to clear that?
You know, I don't know, because I was pushing a little bit for Rad.
The bike one with Nicole Kidman.
No, that's BMX Bandit.
That's BMX Bandit.
This is Lori Loughlin.
Thank you.
Yes.
Yeah. Which one came first? I feel like they're similar.
I think BMX Bandit came first. It was during that time of extreme sports dramas. So there was Rad for BMX and BMX Bandits, of course. There was, for surfing, there was North Shore.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Gleaming the Cube.
Gleaming the Cube, exactly.
I love that one.
And then honorable mention
is Airborne.
A Brother's Vengeance.
Yeah, that's the alternate title.
Yeah.
Was Bandit a hand in that mix? I mean, was that more of like a cop?
Oh, man. I saw that for the first time ever. Oh, yeah. Bandit in the Hand. Michael Mann produced it.
Really? Yeah. Another Skitchin, I think, was another rollerblading one. Yeah. Is that one?
Skitchin?
Oh, Roller Babies.
I don't think I know Roller Babies.
Roller Babies. I remember the VHS cover was like this kind of like Morino star, and then there was like a silhouette of all the kids standing there. Nice. They were like rollerbladers. Roller Babies.
Airborne gets an honorable mention in there, but like Seth Green and Jack Black are in that one.
Oh, wow.
Wow.
And they're all very similar. They're all, you know, someone from somewhere else, and they have to do this thing, but they also should go to college. Like Rad and North Shore have very similar things. They're not horror movies, so maybe we should upset the crowd.
It all ties in. In fact, I was going to ask about your formative years when you fell in love with movies, because obviously you have an affinity for movies now, but your reaction to Slashback Video makes me believe that you probably grew up on the VHS cable generation as well. And so what were those films that made you fall in love with the art of filmmaking?
Again,
besides Rad and Gleaming the Cube.
Yeah, exactly. Movies I watched all the time.
Gleaming the Cube changed my life, guys. Yeah.
Slashback Video, by the way, and I think I said this right, I didn't want to leave when you went in there, and it was really just, you're like, this is so nice. If only I knew then what I know now.
Did you see our shelves? We had our own shelves.
We had our own shelves.
Each one of us had a pick as well.
Yeah.
Actually, mine are still there, apparently.
Jesus,
I thought you were
giving
them to me.
And I just want to correct myself. It's Solar Babies, not Roller Babies.
Solar Babies.
Okay. And there's no rollerblading at all.
And there's no rollerblading in there.
So I completely just fucked that
all. Wow. I've seen Solar Babies.
Yeah.
But I was so excited because Rob Schraub came over to my house this week for another project. And he brought, because he knew I was such a huge fan.
Becca stepped out of the room, doesn't realize that we've talked about all these things.
But while he was there, he brought me a Ballerina Overdrive VHS.
Oh, yeah.
So it is now sitting on my shelf.
Nice. Oh, that's also what we watched after Judgment Day. We watched Fateful Findings, Neil Breen.
I haven't seen that one, but his stuff's bonkers.
Is it insane?
Yeah, it's just insane. Jesus. And a bummer. You know, it's that thing where we're all watching it, we're all riffing it off and having a good time, and then it's that moment where you go, is this kind of mean and exploitative? Just the way people celebrate outsider art is such a fine line of just, are we making fun of this?
But also the way he puts a woman in a bikini or a thong and then makes out with her makes it, to me, it's okay to make fun of him now.
You know what I mean?
Like, he's already crossed the line for you, and now you can go to town.
And that's how
opinion.
I feel about John DeHart with Getaven.
I gotta see that one. Can we pull up Getaven?
Look up the Getaven trailer. If you put Getaven, because it's called
Getaven.
It's called
Getaven. Getaven.
But it puts the titles too close together. Okay. The kerning is real bad.
What year is Getaven?
It's unsearchable. That's my theory. You can't look it up on YouTube.
If you just put in Getaven, Cinefamily, maybe Everything is Terrible.
Oh, okay.
Because I think it was Dimitri and Sookie that found it.
Oh, it's AKA Road to Revenge.
Road to Revenge.
Yeah. And there's two trailers. You can find the trailer they made for the screening that he showed up at and was real uncomfortable.
Ooh.
And then there's also John DeHart's own trailer for it on his YouTube channel.
Oh, my gosh.
Oh, shit. This looks amazing.
I don't know about that. Can you turn your screen slightly?
That's not
Road to Revenge. Yeah. Is this SOV? Sorry,
but
shout
hey, if
video.
You liked Deadly Prey, which I do like,
it. I do love it.
I do like Deadly
Prey. Fans of Deadly Prey, Miami Connection. It's what someone dubbed as Dojo Core, which is someone that made a bunch of money doing something else that said, I'm making a movie.
Dojo Core. John DeHart.
John DeHart. Yeah, he has two songs in it, long sex scenes. And it's just terrible. And there's a couple actors, I'm trying to remember who is it, but there's a couple recognizable people in there, but one of them is clearly just drunk the whole time. It's that kind of stuff.
Is it Wings Houser?
It's got to be Wings.
I think Wings is in a movie like that, and there's a bar scene, kind of country western-y.
Just saying,
oh, this is that movie. Okay, I've heard of this.
Come on, baby, pretty
I love
baby,
Wings,
do the hip slide. Hot damn!
Oh, shit, I know what you're talking about now.
Yeah.
I haven't seen it, but I've seen that.
We should screen this here at Blumhouse.
That sounds like a good time.
If you can find it, I'm trying to. I keep on meaning to get a hold of those people and see, because I don't know if it's out and around. I think they found a copy of it.
Is this only like a VHS release, or
I don't know really. Just because I've never seen it out, never seen it for sale. Mm. But they just got it and screened it, and I'm not sure I'm not sure if they saw his thing and then he brought it to screen.
Right.
But he was wearing a matching windbreaker outfit, and he brought like his own icebox full of natural light.
That is like a character in itself.
Yeah, and then the thing is, it's weird because it's the trailer that the CineFound people made. At the end of it, you know, they cut all the worst parts into it, and then the last part is his old billboard. I remember because I showed it to the guys at Shout Factory, and Michael Rebus was watching. He's like, "That guy looks so familiar. Man, that guy looks so familiar." And at the very end, they show, and he's like, "The guy from the billboard. I used to off the 10. I used to see that every day."
Oh, funny!
He's a trial attorney.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
That's amazing. Wow. Well, when did you move to LA?
We're skipping the big question.
Oh.
Childhood phase.
We went on a crazy thing.
Yeah, we were all on. That's okay.
Childhood traumas. What's the movies that fucked you
yeah,
up?
Yeah, horror. Let's I get was, on the horror.
I was 4 years old. My cousin Kalani babysat me and my brother Adam, and he rented you could rent the VHS, and you got that, and you got Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yes.
And
four is really young.
It was too young, and I still think about it. I still remember watching it and not being uneasy, and then hiding behind the couch and peeking out every once in a while. Mm-hmm. And I remember breaking crayons because I was so scared and nervous. I had a little pail full of crayons, and I was just breaking them because I couldn't handle it.
Did that bleed into your adult life every time you get nervous?
Do you still break crayons?
Yeah.
Every time you see Freddy,
like the Langoliers guy.
Yeah, that's exactly what when I saw that, like Bronson Pinchot doing it, I was like, I get it, buddy.
Yeah, Langoliers reference, guys.
Yeah, that's nice.
I've written, I don't know if any of them really got in, but I've written like multiple Langoliers references.
I thought you were going to say fan fiction.
No. Like there was like this one thing. It was like, "What's that sound?" And I was like, "Sounds like Rice Krispies.
Sounds like heels on pavement."
Yeah.
Langoliers and Tommyknockers. I watched them. Like, I love Tommyknockers, and I don't know why, because it's garbage, but I love it.
Yeah. Anytime there's a green light, I was like, Tommyknocking.
Yeah. I want my lipstick to do that all the time. So.
So that was my first horror, and of course, because I was born in '82, so and we had HBO, and so all HBO showed was horror. That's all they had. And then also, you know, right around, I'm trying to remember, was it 88 or 89 when Tales from the Crypt
started.
Yeah. And so, you know, like all these horror movies are playing on HBO all the time. It's all they could afford to play.
And Beastmaster.
The Beastmaster. It was lots of horror. So, you know, Dawn of the Dead, original, like Creepshow 2. And we had this conversation where you don't like that I like Creepshow 2 more than I like Creepshow 1.
Yeah.
But it's because of, it's based in just how much I saw it.
I'm with you. I think it was just on so much Creepshow, I think of 2 because that's the one I'd always see. Mm-hmm. I love them both. Now as an adult, I see the error of my ways. Know. I get what you mean.
Yeah, Creepshow 2 over Creepshow 1 is something crazy like Fright Night 2 over Fright Night.
Yes. Fright Night 2.
I get it. I wonder who that could be.
I'll go to bat for the Fright Night remake.
Actually, I like it.
It's not bad.
Paul Farrell's great.
I get it because I saw Caddyshack 2 way more than Caddyshack 1. I didn't actually watch Caddyshack 1 until I was in college.
Oh, no.
And so for the longest time, I associated Caddyshack with Caddyshack 2.
Wow, you're doing like, Bill Murray's doing this terrible Dan Aykroyd. Yeah. I'll say this about Creepshow 2.
Yeah, go, please.
So Creepshow 2, overall, better than Creepshow 2. Creepshow 1, better than Creepshow 2. But The Raft, better than any other creep show.
It's right
and
up
that's,
there, yeah.
And that's why it makes it.
Are you a Chief Woodenhead fan? Because that's always the one I struggle with. But sometimes we have met somebody who liked that one the most in part 2, which blew our minds. Remember?
Nobody ever liked Chief Woodenhead the most.
I know, it's crazy. It's not a good short at all.
I appreciate it now, though.
I don't know. I still can't.
Not my jam.
Yeah, it's not the best one.
How long was it, like, after being freaked out by Nightmare, how long was it before you, like, wanted to kind of chase the dragon and get over that fear?
It was about... I was about 6 years old is when I would always tell myself, like, you're probably going to dream about Freddy tonight. Make friends with him. Tell him how much of a fan you are of his.
Yeah.
I think Poltergeist 3, what year did Poltergeist 3 come out?
It was around, I want to say, 89 or 90.
And speaking of a film that's better than its predecessor.
Yeah, we love Poltergeist 3. That's like one of our like collective.
Gags.
But you know
so
what?
Good.
I think because now that you mention it, well, like all of us collectively, well, I don't know about Ryan, but all the rest of us love Poltergeist 3. That was one of those HBO movies that I'd see more than any of the
other
ones.
And I watched it over and over. Like I remember specific scenes of it, like when he caresses her face and rips her cheek off. And like I have vivid
it was like the
memories.
Gags, like the mirror gags. There was just so much
the,
like cool
the mirror
things
stuff is what messed me up because. I remember right around then we moved into a new house and I had the closet with the mirrors and I was just like, nope.
Yeah.
Never put your hands up to it. Your hands are going to grab your hands and throw you up in the air and then it's
the darkness. Whole thing.
But yeah, there was me and my brother Adam and my friend Donald, we all loved horror stuff. So, you know, it's like my friend Don would come over and we'd watch Tales from the Crypt. And then every Friday night we'd go to the video store and I would spend way too much time in the horror section trying to figure out what to rent. And a lot of times we would just go, well, let's just rent, you know, Dawn of the Dead again. Because that was like our go-to. And Return of Living Dead, that was, I didn't know it was a comedy.
Mm.
You know, I thought it was a scary movie. Mm-hmm. And then as you get older, you realize that it's just the best zombie movie.
Yeah.
But then it's as it progressed, I just kind of, it was just one of those things where you start to become more discerning and then you start to kind of really look at the box and go, this looks spooky, you know, and then you kind of go, I don't know, it looks cheap. Is it going to be any good? And then, you know, all the Child's Plays were coming out around that time.
Yeah.
And then, you know, I had my cousin Kalani was always really cool. He was older than us. He was always really cool about taking us to see horror movies because my parents didn't really care. And so I was able to go and see a lot of these the Jason and Freddy movies and in the theater. And that was always fantastic.
Yeah.
And then the next one that really messed me up, where I was like a horror kid, you know, it's like nothing scares me anymore. I'm tough. And then Candyman messed me up.
Yeah.
Messed me up real bad. I remember I didn't see in the theater, but we rented that in A League of Their Own. my mom got to pick one. Yeah. And we watched Candyman while my mom made, I think it was like, there was like a sale on crab legs at the store. So she made crab legs that night. So the house just reeked of like garlic butter and crab legs. And we watched Candyman. And I was just like, I was so scared the whole time that I got tired and I just wanted to go to bed. And then I went to bed and I kind of fell asleep. And then I kind of woke up and I woke up on my back. And I never sleep on my back, and I thought that was weird. And I could just smell crab legs. Every time I smell crab legs, I think of
Candyman.
I love the free association that comes with it.
Yeah,
Candyman, crab legs,
and also my brother. I could hear him watching A League of Their Own, and I was on my back, and I could have sworn that if I opened up my eyes, Candyman would be hovering above me, like he hovers above her in the hospital. And I couldn't open my eyes, and I was so scared, and I couldn't move because I thought I would touch him, and if I touched him, he would kill me. And also I could just, so I'm hearing, like I'm thinking that I'm smelling crab and butter and garlic. And I was like, we are the members of the All-American.
So you're drawn, but you're at a certain point drawn to the feeling of the scary. Cause like a lot of people, I think comedians will like horror comedies, but a lot of people I meet, they actually like scary horror. And Ryan had mentioned to us that you really like the scary stuff.
Yeah.
And so like, is that something you then started seeking out that feeling? Like, did you enjoy the feeling afterwards?
Some people say, why do I want to watch it? And there's a very funny scene in the new season of Love where Mike Mitchell's character, Randy, why would you want to be scared? You know? And it's the same type of thing of the roller coaster. It's simulated fear. It's not real fear.
Yeah.
It's not a real thing you have to be scared of. And you're going to be okay. You're at home or you're in a theater. But it's that real life adrenaline burst of, and that tension that a lot of people don't get. And that's what I like about it. And as I watch more and more horror movies, I'm just looking for that stuff. So I don't mind jump scare movies because it's still that moment. It's a big drop on a roller coaster. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with those.
Now, do you like roller coasters too?
Yeah, I do. But if I go on more than like three, I get a real bad headache and
me
I don't
too.
Know why.
I was at Disneyland last week and I can ride like two rides before I'm like, I don't feel well and I need to sit down. And so I realized that this is my adrenaline.
Becca, yeah,
it's a small world. Isn't that bad?
Oh my God. I throw up and it was just terrible.
Every time going into Pirates, I'm just like, whoa!
Do you have a subgenre? Because like we talk about our like subgenre loves all the time, but like how some people don't like home invasion movies because it's too close to like
that's me.
That's my
wife, like him. And I remember meeting John Landis once, and he said his wife could look at anything, but anything about real life killer, she just that was couldn't do it because it was too close to reality.
Yeah, I don't do serial, like Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, I saw once. I never have to see it again. I don't like movies like that.
Yeah.
So what do you chase? Like what's that thing? Everyone has, I like crazy, weird, she likes nun movies.
She likes nun
movies. Aquatic horror.
Yeah.
I get a kick out of haunted stuff because I was raised Catholic, and that fear of people watching you so you feel guilty all the time. And if you mess up, it's eternal damnation.
Sure.
That stuff really gets to me. So that's why I really enjoyed the Conjuring movies. And I just had such a blast, especially Conjuring 2, which I think I liked more than Conjuring 1. Because it was just, I'm still scared of the dark, you know, a little bit. So that haunting stuff is the supernatural is really what gets me going.
Isn't that funny that we're growing ass adults? And I'm the same way. Like, it's still about the dark if I'm alone. If there's other people there, I never think about it. No. But when you're alone in the dark, it's so weird. And I wonder if that's something to do with our childhoods and movies.
I still have a nightlight, guys. You know? I mean, like, so it looks like an adult. Like, it's like a nice lamp now, but
it's a lava lamp. It's pretty adult.
It's pretty testy. No. Like, it's one of those, like, hippie salt lamp things where, you know, it releases ions into the air and it's nice pink glow. But man, like, a couple times it's burnt out in the middle of the night and I wake up in pitch blackness and I'm like, what the fuck is going on? Like, I freak.
Yeah. It's just primal, I guess. Lovecraftian primal. The darkness is unknowable.
We don't know what's there. Right. And that's fine. It's the, you know, I remember when I was in high school and there were just, you'd see like, you know, in a movie or in a TV show, just the dad or the mom like turning off the lights in the house. I was like, when I'm an adult, that's not going to happen.
No, and I've got, we actually have lights built into the light switches in some of the rooms so that like as soon as something moves, it like this small glow comes up just so I can be like, find my way to the bathroom and make sure there's no killers there.
Yeah. No, it's, there was the thing with, I remember Freddie, I got over, like I said, as a kid, because like I thought I could buddy up with him. I thought he was funny. I was a funny kid. Yeah. You know, we could work that
Trade
out.
Jokes. Talk your way out of it.
Yeah, exactly. And then I was obsessed with zombie movies. So I was pretty certain, like I watched so many zombie movies, I knew what I could do and I knew where to go and I knew how to handle myself.
Mm-hmm. Did you delve into all the Italian knockoff stuff too?
Yeah, somewhat. It's, you know, I was at the mercy of our local tiny video store.
Where was this, by the way?
This is in Kailua, which is a small town on the windward side of Oahu in Hawaii.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so they didn't, Video Joe was the local one. And
Video Joe?
Video Joe.
That's awesome.
Yeah, Video Joe was great. Really cool. It was this guy, him and his long-term boyfriend, they wanted to start like a business together. And his whole thing is like, I'll start a cafe. And he's like, well, I want to start like a video store. The one who wanted to start a video store, got cancer and died. And so his name was Joe. And so his boyfriend was like, I'm going to start that video store in honor of Joe.
Oh,
so
it's
called Video Joe. And I started going in there.
This is for Video Joe today. I love that story.
Dedicated to Video Joe.
It was really great. It held on for a good 5 years, I think, 4 or 5 years. And I would go in all the time just to look around. And the guy who ran it was so great. And I would always want a job there, but they rented porn. So I was, you know, 15 at the time, and so I wasn't allowed. But he would start to kind of, he had all the magazines there, and he said, hey, there's a movie coming out, there's coming into the store on Friday, I'll put it off to the side for you, it's a horror movie, it's a scary movie, I think you're going to like it. That's how I found out about Bottle Rocket. He's like, I think you're really going to like this. He would start to do stuff like that.
Yeah.
And then Blockbuster opened up, literally a block and a half away, and just decimated the place. And I remember I was there, he said, hey, we're closing up the shop. You can work this last week. If you want to come after school, you can help me pack up. Your payment will be credit towards the store. And so I was able to get like tons of movie posters and like movie posters that like some I liked, some that I don't, you know, I didn't need a high school high poster, but I had one. I helped him kind of box everything. I had tons of, that's when I really got going with my VHS collection, where I had up to about 400.
Wow.
Yeah, at that time, just from buying some and then getting a ton from there. Right. And also dumpster diving behind Blockbusters when they were switching to DVD. I'm not sure if any of you ever did that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
So doing a lot of that. But we're packing it up, and I remember it was a real emotional time for him. And then a teacher that I hated, like in school, she came in and she said, oh, yeah, I'm going to buy some stuff. And it's, you know, I love this place, but, you know, I was always going to Blockbuster because they always had what I wanted. And the guy was like, okay, You know, you could tell it was affecting him, and she's, but you know, these things are cool, but it's, you know, that's the way it goes. And he's all, you know, can you please get out? And she's, I'm sorry. He's all, get out, get the fuck out. Can you get the fuck out of my store? Wow. And he started to cry. And she's like, well, you're very rude. And he's all, well, you're very shitty. And then grabbed her stuff, threw it at her, and then she stormed.
Yes.
Oh my gosh.
Video
go
Joe heroism.
Justice for Video Joe.
That's awesome.
Wow. I think about that, and it's one of those things where, pre-internet stuff. I want to know what he went on to do and went on, you know.
Yeah.
So because it's just like there's those weird. It's important. We all have them. The video store people.
I remember them very distinctly.
Yeah.
Isn't that funny? Blockbuster was both the best and worst thing to happen at the same time. Because when you're like 12, like I was, there were three mom and pop shops I'd walk to, but then there was Blockbuster, and it's like, all right, so I go to the mom and pop shop, I get my obscure horror movies, but they're out of Batman. And then you go to Blockbuster, like, they have 100 copies of freaking Batman. I'm going to see that big Hollywood movie. Like, your brain doesn't realize that you are supporting, you're killing the other stores by supporting that one.
It's also when they started becoming a one-stop shop for everything else. I mean, I sadly contributed to the problem by working there, like circa
Blockbuster.
I worked at Blockbuster
in New York, 32nd and 3rd. And it was around the time where Blockbuster was becoming more than just a video store. It was a place for food. It was a place for all, like, toys. Yeah. If you needed Lost World Jurassic Park action figures, that's where you went. And I was just kind of like, That's why then I became the buyer, and I started, building the largest horror selections. That way, when they went into the $2 bin, I was like, thank you very much.
Nice.
I will buy these back from you.
I will buy this copy of Carnosaur.
Yeah.
Bleeders with the...
Bleeders with the squishy cover. I still have
Becca's
mine.
Favorite. Yeah, I gave that back to you, right, Becca?
You did. I got my Bleeders back.
You know, nice. Some people come pick up their video.
I never got that memo.
No one keeps my Bleeders.
Something like getting a text message from my Mystic Museum partners, and they're like, so we have this clock that needs to go back. And I was like, yep, here's the address. And we got Elric Kane's tapes.
That's the most Elric thing I've ever heard.
You guys can pick them up.
I remember in high school, it was like dates and who I was hanging out with by which video store we went to. Because we had On Track Video, which was this adorable little tape logo, and the wheels were the spokes, and it was like a choo-choo train of video cassettes. On Track, they had the Beaded Curtain Porn Room, and they had the best horror collection. But if it was like somebody who was a non-horror fan, then we headed to Blockbuster so we could rent whatever trendy high school high movie came out. So,
Did they have like Fangoria out there? And
To go to see...
I feel like I'm asking like New Zealand questions.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Tell us what it was like on your side of the world.
We had Fangoria in New Zealand, so that's the amazing part.
I would take the canoe. Are you from New Zealand?
Yeah. And my last name's Kane, and in Hawaiian, that would be
Kane,
man.
Which means man.
I feel like Alice Cooper in Wayne's World right now. Yeah. Running stream.
Just a quick aside, the movie Boy by Taika Waititi.
Yeah, it's a good movie.
It's a great movie, and it was I got drunk at a party, and he was there, and I was just like, I'm just going to tell him how much Boy means to me, because I'd never seen a movie that felt like it was from Hawaii, way everyone talks.
They're Polynesian,
They're Polynesian, and the pigeon is kind of similar, and I was like, no one's ever made a movie like that in Hawaii, and to see that, it filled me with so much emotion, and like also reminded me of my messed up, you know, convict family, and he's like, right. It's just like a big white guy going, it's like your movie about, you know, like low income Maori people in New Zealand.
I'll now recount my most shameful story, which is I had a film in the New Zealand Film Festival, and he had Boy showing, and I was at the urinal, and I just turned to him, and he went to the urinal, and I turned to him and went, oh man, I love your movie, and I held my hand up, and he looked at me and went, yeah, nah. And that was our interaction. Yeah. And then he went on to do Thor. And I'm here.
And he's he is somewhere telling stories of this guy who tried to shake his hand at the urinal.
That no budget guy.
It was a funny kind of like analogous thing to that. His really good friend is Ian Morris, who's the guy who created one of the guys who created The Inbetweeners in England, really great show. And he lives out here now, and me and him have kind of become buddies. And we were we went to a bar. We were just, you know, drinking getaways. We're both complaining about like stuff. He's working on a movie. I'm working on like a show, and we're just kind of grumbling. And then I get a text from my friend Kumail Nanjiani, mm-hmm. Who was, you know, in the middle of the big, you know, working through the award season with mm-hmm. his with the Big Sick. And then he's like, "Hey, where are you?" I was like, "Oh, I'm hanging out with Ian Morris over at this bar. Come on by." He said, "Oh, cool." And then Ian gets a text from Taika. Going like, "Where do you go?" He's, "Oh, I'm at this place with Jonah. Come on by." And then they show up together from this fancy party. And me and Ian have been there for like 3 hours. And we're both like unshaven, messy hair, like, you know, so many pints deep. And then in come in our gorgeous, successful brown friends. Like Taika and Kumail walking in there in suits. And then like they were just like, we just talked to Steven Spielberg for like 3 hours. And we're like, rad. It was just this weird meeting. I can't remember. That was just a fun aside. I'm trying
but
to remember.
But you found your success, man. I mean, like,
oh, we all have. It's, you know,
yeah,
it's all a crazy train.
What's like in terms of recent scare movies? Have you seen anything the last few? Can you still feel that, or are you kind of past that actual feeling? Like even good horror now, it might unnerve or unsettle, but mm-hmm. to actually scare you, can you still get to that feeling?
I don't know. It's close. I mean, we're all chasing the dragon, right?
Yeah, that's what it is.
It's your. We're all
Elric
trying
is
to
all about that.
Yeah.
Chasing the dragon.
We're trying to find that thing that happened a long time ago, where you got that spike the first time, and you know, and the search is fun, and the culture is even better. You know, I think that's the thing that, you know, keeps me paying attention and involved. Is just it's just the culture of horror is just so inclusive and fun and goofy, and it always seems a lot less angry than, you know, sci-fi fans, comedy fans for sure, but you know, it's just every time I start talking when I find someone else that's really into horror, it's an immediate
kinship.
It's kinship, and you find where, you know, like where you're at with that. It's immediate. I don't know. It's almost like when you find out someone also is into punk, and you kind of there's this now baseline thing that you can agree upon. But I'm trying to think. Like the last, you know, what unsettled me was that, like, Lake Bodum. You know,
that one
was a surprise
very
for
effective,
me.
Yeah.
Did you see Veronica on Netflix? That's one that everyone's been talking
not
about.
Yet. Shockwaves approved.
Shockwaves approved.
I didn't find it scary.
It had a couple of moments for me. Yeah,
it's well made. Sometimes it's like this. We're in this period where it's things that are fringe to horror. Like I thought the last time I was like affected was like Green Room. Like in terms of like an experience. Like,
yeah.
Oh my god, I just survived that movie and it was so tense.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter if it's horror or not, but that's a similar feeling to like watching Nightmare for the first time, mm-hmm. even though they're not, you know.
Mm-hmm. I did. Wreck was and granted that was like 10 years ago now. Wreck was one that I was like, okay, that scared me.
Yeah. There's that's the thing too about the spectrum of horror where there. We're like the Conjuring movies where there's that, you know, you go, I did a Doug Benson interruption. We did the Conjuring, I think the first Conjuring, and you know, it was at Cinefilm, where the front couches, and you know, when you're, you know, just riffing on a movie and it's not planned or anything like that, you kind of just sit with the mic in front of you, you know, your elbows on your belly, just in case you think of something you want to say real fast. But what I didn't realize was that the entire audience could hear me going, and I don't think I ever really noticed myself doing that until I got a little loud. I was like, oh, fuck. It is just that fun churning of fear, which was pretty great. The Green Room was something where I wish I saw it in a theater. Someone had a copy of it.
It was super effective in the theater, I got to say. Like, I mean, I'm not even kidding. It was the first movie I can remember where I was chewing nails.
Yeah.
And then afterwards I looked down and I was like, oh my
it's
God.
It's intense. Yeah. It's just an intense movie. It's not scary. It's just intense and it goes for the throat. It's just
Autopsy of Jane Doe had moments where I was definitely spooky. Like was, holding my breath moments.
That's spooky.
Yeah, right? That one was real spooky. Great, great visuals. Like the feet, when you first see the feet kind of walking. But just that unease was so good. And we were at Fantastic Fest that year. And we couldn't get into any of the screenings of it. And I just had to keep on walking. Because it was, you know, when you decide you're going to see it without seeing a trailer, like when you just kind of, you're like, oh, that sounds neat. I'm going to see it. And then you have to avoid everything.
Which I'm doing with Hereditary. I haven't seen anything. I'm just like,
Hereditary
blind.
Looks so cool. So in Hereditary, so hard not to read about it.
So in Hereditary, there's this moment when... I think, you know, going back to the Chasing the Dragon thing, I think it's like also just becoming an older horror fan, you know? I think it's less chasing the dragon, but finding something that I can impart to a younger generation and go, guys, you're going to have your minds blown. That's the thrill I get now. It's like, I always appreciated the fact that my parents would go, well, honey, you really need to see American Werewolf in London if you really like The Wolfman. And I'm like, oh my God, what's that movie?
It's more becoming a
Jedi master as opposed to, you know, just like kind of chasing Elder that
Statesman.
Thrill that will never, yeah, yeah. Elder yeah, Statesman.
But that's, I think, yeah. that's the record store guy, that's yeah. the video store.
I like that. What's the
thrill? I mean, the chasing dragon, we want to be scared, but more than that, I think people, like all of us, it's the thrill of the hunt is the most important thing. Like when you go and discover something that somehow you don't think all your friends had seen yet, that still feels as good as it did when I was a kid.
Yeah. Like it still
something
feels
with a bonkers scene in it or something that's surprising or scary.
I am so excited for you guys to watch Dance Macabre now because I just watched that. Yeah. No one has seen it. Have you seen Dance Macabre?
I have not.
Oh my God, this is like Robert Englund weird is the only way I can describe it from 92. I talk about it at the top of the show. Right. But I'm so excited for people to see it now because it's something that I discovered and I'm going to have to call Jeff Nelson because I'm sure he's
our friends
seen
at Shout Factory, Scream Factory put it out.
Yes. Oh, nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah.
I got a ton of stuff from them. That was a nice perk of being the host of Mr. Sensei. Yeah. Outside of being the host, they're like, here's.
Check out this
But you
shit.
Get DVDs.
Like, watch
here's
the all vault. This.
Do you get like a free loot crate or something with that?
I asked. There was like, they just showed me into the vault, and I was like, oh, well, here, I'll take this one. I'll take Motel Hell, and I'll take this. I'll take body bags. And then they're just, seriously, just go for it. And then I had two huge tote bags full of stuff. And I'm walking out, and then I saw the complete Larry Sanders Show box. And I was like, can I get that too? They're like, no.
I tried that.
That's where they draw the line.
Yeah. No, because I get like review copies of all of the Scream Factory films. And when the Larry Sanders one and when the Decline of Western Civilization came out, I messaged for both of those and was like, can I get these? And they were like, well, they're not really hard.
Not really hard.
yeah.
Okay.
Fair enough. I get it.
Rip Torn can be pretty spooky. Oh,
yeah. I know, right?
I'm trying to think of an old movie that I saw for the first time that I think it was Magic. I just recently saw Magic.
Super creepy.
That trailer, I remember we had an article on the Blumhouse site about how there's like an entire generation of people who were traumatized by just that trailer.
Well, that was the concept of Ronnie Asher's stock.
That was pretty interesting.
That was well done.
I wish that was a series. I mean, I know it's going to be a series, but I want more of that. Like that's fascinating. You mentioned being Catholic horror fan. So was Exorcist an early film, or did you watch it a lot later?
I wasn't really allowed to watch it. I don't think because it was sacrilegious. I think my parents were scared when they saw it, and so they thought it would be just too much with the amount of Catholic imagery. That was in my life already. But the first time I saw The Exorcist, I think it was ninth grade was by the time I saw it. I think that's when it came back out in the theaters.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And
with the spider walk.
Which
was great.
I saw the spider walk, and I think I ended up with my feet on top of the chairs, like armrest, just like crouched.
There's those weird flash frames of the face that come over. I find them to be terrifying. Like it's funny what can scare you. It doesn't need to be a construct. Like it could be just this little thing.
Yeah, I love every time really I'm scared. In DC, I go to the stairs. Yeah, cool. But it's right next to the Georgetown, so it's like when you want to like lay upside down backwards on the staircase, you're in the way of so many dudes trying to like run up it for exercise. So many people use it.
It's right in the middle of the campus and it's near the law building.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's a pretty heavily trafficked area.
Yeah, people use it and you're like, this should be sectioned off for
self. Get out of the way, healthy guy. I'm trying to take my nerd photos. Yeah. Fuck out of here. How dare you? For you being a horror fan, I mean, like your career trajectory has been, all over the place. You're exploring so much. You're doing MST3K. You were working with Chris. For you, have you ever thought about getting behind the camera and directing a horror feature?
Or? Yeah, it's an odd thing where I wanted growing up, watching movies and going to, especially to when I became aware of the Hawaiian International Film Festival, and that's how I saw Brain Dead. Oh man, because there's the two names.
Dead Alive or
Dead Alive. Yeah. Yeah,
Brain Dead in New Zealand.
Dead Alive. And getting to see that. I saw Battle Royale the year it came out, and just really getting into the idea of making stuff, because I was playing in punk bands and, you know, we record and try to put out like 7-inch records and stuff. But the idea of being in entertainment, which was really driving force for me, especially because I was obsessed with Mel Brooks and Albert Brooks and John Carpenter and Ed Wood. You know,
who also was talked about?
Yeah, we talked about that. You're on a roll.
Yeah, Ed Wood is my all-time favorite movie.
Oh yeah, like,
we talked about that at the top of the show about how it is a flawless film.
It is great, and my favorite part. I've talked about it for years so much, but it's about it's a movie about friendship and creativity.
This is our exact conversation.
And doing stuff because it's you're doing stuff.
You were hiding under the table, weren't you?
No,
I was showing it to young filmmakers, right, and who hadn't seen it at all. And what's so interesting is when it ends, like, I sit there and I'm like, it's so interesting that film about like the guy who's meant to be the worst filmmaker. The thing you want to do as soon as it ends is make movies. Mm-hmm. Like, it is just so inspiring. Much better than about the Orson Welles. You know, even though Welles is in there. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's so inspiring to want to make movies, which is, it just almost feels counterintuitive, but it totally works.
It really, really, truly does. And so, you know, I wanted to be, and I loved comedy too. And I was a, you know, big, fat, white kid growing up in Hawaii. So I had to be funny, because even my, like, you know, my dad's side of the family were brown, and I was an outcast in my own family. My mom's side of the family, who were white, lived in California. So we'd see him every once in a while. And I would even feel out of place over there, because I was just like, these people are really white. you know, they're just howlies to me. But, you know, not really, always kind of being out of place and real sore thumb, you know, real tall, and just a nerd, you know, and like a big guy that didn't play sports. And it was just a real, you know, so I became funny, and like I really glommed on to comedy, especially because, you know, Mr. Show was out and Kids in the Hall, and it really, you know, that also spoke to my punk rock, you know, ideas of just putting on a show, and same with MST. And so comedy seemed like the thing I would do, just because I was known as being a funny kid. But I wanted to do it all. And when I came out to LA, you know, when you get out here, it's so big and so scary. And I was 19, and I was working at a record store in Venice Beach, living in San Pedro. And I was taking a couple classes at SMC, you know, film classes. I was like, I'm going to go here and I'm going to learn some stuff, and then I'll go and sign up for the Groundlings, and, you know, do that side and this. And then 9/11 happened, and I quit it all. Like, I thought everything was going to shut down. I thought the world was going to end. I thought, you know, ships were going to come up on Santa Monica Beach, and, you know, everything was going to be done. So I just kind of hung out with punk bands and went on tour as a roadie and drank and worked at a record store and,
oh, wow,
and lived my life. I didn't go, you know, I didn't go back to college or anything like that. And so, but I wanted to be in showbiz, and you just, you know, like, you read this stuff and it's like, well, get an internship out of college. And I was like, I can't do that. Couldn't afford Los Angeles Film School, which I, you know, had just opened up, I think, around there, and and so I realized with comedy, with, like, you can go and sign up at a coffee shop for an open mic, and you sign your name down, they call your name, and you go up on stage, and holy shit, you're in show business, you're in Los Angeles, and you're on a stage performing, and people are watching you. And for me, it I didn't really ever think about being a stand-up comic, but it got me noticed, and then I started getting on better shows, and I started working more on material, and then I started getting on other shows. And then right around the time, that's like the M-Bar comedy scene, which would become Comedy Bang Bang eventually.
Yeah.
That's when all those people started, you know, doing stuff, and I became a writer on shows. And then it was just a way to get into showbiz. And then, you know, when you're young and you don't have a definitive thing, it's like, I wanted to make shorts. I remember trying to get BJ Novak before he was, you know, The Office and stuff like that. Like, we're all just stand-ups. I was like, let's start making little videos, and we'll show him. We'll show him at like the M-Bar show. And he's like, why? Like, who? So we'll just show it to a few people, and that's it. I was like, well, I think I know a guy with a projector, and I can get some foam core, and we can show it. I realized, it's like, if I had just gone on my own and just started making these videos, I would have had a bunch of like little shorts that I made right when YouTube came out.
Yeah.
And I would have, like, and that's like a lot of the people that got picked up on YouTube early on, the comics, were kids that were already making shorts. Mm-hmm. And then Channel 101 started by Rob Schraub and Dan Harmon. And I went to the first one. I was like, this sounds up my alley, just little filmmaker people. Like, I was constantly trying to get that way, but the jet stream was keeping me in the performing and writing area of, you know, sketch and stand-up and joke writing and stuff. And I went to the first Channel 101, and I squeezed in. It was at Toy on Sunset. And I was like, maybe this will be my alley. And then just all these videos, people had special effects in them. And I was like, I don't even have a computer. I thought people were going to be, you know, editing like I did when I was a kid from VCR to VCR.
Tape to tape.
Yeah. And so, you know, I just kind of kept on following the path that was, and it almost led me to just being a producer for horrible e-entertainment, countdown shows. I was a producer on E's 50 Most Insane Celebrity Oops.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was terrible. And you know, I kept on, you know, kind of directing music videos and directing stuff. And so it was a weird thing where every time everyone wants to compartmentalize you in the industry. So when I would be like, it's like, oh yeah, I want to like direct the thing. They're like, oh, you want to be a director now? Or it's like, I was like, oh, I'm auditioning for this thing. Oh, you want to be an actor now? I thought you were a writer, or I thought you were a comic or something like that. So I've kind of just tried my best to scattershot, and I don't know if that was the right way to go, because now like I'm almost at this jack of all trades place in my life and career. And so, you know, I'm constantly trying to develop stuff that's like would be a show that I would, you know, be in, or a show that I would direct, or a movie that I would, you know, direct or produce and be in, you know, that kind of stuff. It's just I'm now at a point now where it's like I was like, I just have to start doing it and you know, quit waiting around. And a good example, like a thing that was very motivating, was being friends with Kumail Nanjiani and Emily Gordon, who just, no one was asking them to make the Big Six script when they started. But, you know, Judd Apatow wanted to start doing stand-up again. And so he started coming to the Meltdown show that we were doing at Meltdown Comics. And he like asked them, like, how'd you guys get together? And then they told him, and they said, well, you know, we're actually kind of writing a script about that right now. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'll help you with that. And it's just because they had already started the process. They already had something to show them. And it's that kind of stuff where just to see where it went, you know literally they got they're Oscar-nominated writers.
Yeah. Yeah.
My idiot friends are Oscar-nominated writers.
And that other comedian.
And they lost to our other comedy friend, you know.
Yeah.
I like that Meltdown was a hub for so much talent. Mm-hmm. Like,
it's incredible, and it's sad that it's closed.
Are they officially, they closed?
Is it?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
Gaston just announced it today. They're just kind of closing it up. It's on his own accord. He just has other stuff he wants to do.
Right.
It's real weird, because that place was, you know, I was doing shows there since 2009, 2008.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. So I was going there before they opened the back area for stuff.
Yeah. I went to so many Nerdist parties there. I hugged Weird Al there.
Yes.
I saw Clive Barker had his Tortured Souls toy line signing.
That's right.
I got to meet his daughter.
That's your big emotional moment. It's like, oh, the Johnson McFarlane.
No. Clive was there.
Okay.
He was there with his partner David and his daughter. And, you know, I was just like, oh, love to have you sign this. And he was like, oh, yes, of course. And then I was like, and this Rawhead Rex thing. And he's like,
Were you in town for BFest when they showed Rawhead Rex?
Yes. No, I was. I went to that one. So that was
great. That was the best Beyond Fest yet, I think.
Really?
Was that the latest one?
That was the last one.
Yeah, I was there every night. It was just Rawhead Rex looks so good. Like, Rawhead Rex was never meant to look that good.
Yeah.
And I mean, he's shiny and kind of penis-like with a receding hairline anyway. And on the large screen, it just gets even more plasticky. It was just, I love that movie. And I remember I talked about it on the show right afterwards, because that's what I talked about, how for the first half of the movie, Rex literally does nothing. He just goes into people's houses and like smashes dishes and breaks a door, and then runs off into the countryside to find the next house.
Wow.
Yeah, he's like, Rex smash, and then he's off to the next house, and then he pees on someone.
Rex,
just a drunk guy.
Man, that really bums me out about Meltdown. I'm still processing that. Because I thought I saw it just like a little fleeting Facebook post going, Meltdown for the 50% off sale. And I was like, why?
It's Gaston told me about it last week. And, you know, him and Christian Parks from Neon and stuff like that. Yeah. Like, they have plans to do stuff. And Gaston's kind of stuck there a lot of time, because none of the other owners are there ever or running. So it's all on him.
Sure.
And so he's like, it's time for me to, like, you know, 25 years, that's good to sell goofy comic books for 25 years, you know? And that's, I think it's one of those things, it's sad, but it's also great for a guy that's cultivated so many amazing things, mm-hmm. like in communities, and yeah. you know, and just promoted so much art and fun in this scene.
Yeah,
you know?
Everything comes to an end.
Yeah.
Oh, a couple quick ones. What's the dream title that if you guys could use for the show, like if money was not a factor,
or
that you would most like to make
man
part of that show?
Maximum Overdrive was one that I really pushed for really hard. It would be, because I love the movie so much, it would probably be Dawn of the Dead.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Just because.
But could you be funny with that?
I think so, because I think Dawn of the Dead is it's when you, when there's certain elements that make a really good Mystery Science Theater thing, and you really learn that when you're in it. You know, there's, and it's pacing. It's mm-hmm. like you need room for your show yeah. and the movie to exist, cohabitate mm-hmm. the area. And, you know, Joel Hodgson is very, he's all, don't disrespect the movie, don't talk over their lines. You know, go just in between the lines, yeah. find the empty spots, because when they're talking, the movie's getting something done.
Yeah. yeah.
And the more you know about the movie, the easier the jokes are going to be later down the line.
Yeah.
And as you establish what the characters are doing and stuff like that. And so, yeah, it's but Dawn of the Dead is something where I think there's a lot of space. There's nice space to fill there with bits, but no riff writing process is ever fun. You're doing 10 minutes a day. You're looking at 10 minutes over and over and over and over again. And then you still don't have enough when you're piecing together. It's ones and zeros. You have a spreadsheet with time code on it. And you're like, all right, at 0, 0.
And what's the deciding process for the things that do work when you riff? I mean, is it like everybody's in tears and you're like, that's so good? Or is it just like,
like any kind of joke writing, you just kind of, the room knows.
Yeah.
You know, when someone says something and everyone laughs, you go, good. But sometimes, though, you go, oh, that's great. And you mark it. And that's the joke you want for that moment. And then when you riff produce, which is, you know, when you're the nitty gritty of picking all the jokes to go in and putting it into the, you know, the Excel sheet, you go, oh, that joke was so great. And then you realize it doesn't really fit. Oh. It's the way for that joke to be funny has to be this many words. You try to pare down the words. You try to cut down. Can we still get the same idea across with, you know, a few less words? Shoot, there's that. It cuts to a whole new scene. So by the time you hear the punchline, the viewer's seeing something completely different. Mm. And that's where the real ticky-tacky irritation comes in, where you go, it's, or like, you know, so you don't want something in the old movies, the movies that are paced just not too well. So that you have these moments where someone says something like, I don't think we can go there. And then you, it's like beat, beat, beat. For no real reason, the filmmaker decided to just stretch out before cutting to something else. Mm-hmm. And when you have that space there, and then you're on your way.
Mm.
But it's a real way more laborious process than I ever would have ever thought.
And when do you guys start shooting the new season?
I think in the next few months. I'm not sure. They haven't really set a date on that yet. They got to build everything because we're still writing all the episodes.
Right,
so there's
lots
of props and stuff like that got to be built. And we're probably Joel's been talking about doing another tour, which was a lot of fun last year and stuff like that.
Did you guys actually do live shows?
We did. Yeah, wow. We did. We re-riffed EGA.
As you should.
Yeah.
And I've seen the one on Netflix for EGA. Didn't you guys have one for EGA?
They did it in the original run, and then we re-riffed it for the tour, which was a lot of fun. A
lot of EGA.
Yeah. And then the other one was Argo Man, the Fantastic Superman, which was an Italian. He's like a sexy 60s spy guy that's also a superhero, but he loses his powers for 6 hours. After he has sex, he loses his power for 6 hours.
Oh no!
Yeah, and it's real. That was a lot of fun. But we were doing, like, you know, theater shows, or, you know, we had the Satellite Love set. It was rear projection, so we come out and do, like, you know, the opening, a song, a sketch, you know, props, and then it would be movie sign, and the screen would do the going down the tunnel, and we'd run around the screen and then get up on a platform behind the screen. And so it was rear projection, so our silhouettes were there.
Oh, very cool.
And it was exhausting. And then also, like, the tour bus bunk that I was sleeping in was an inch taller than me.
Yeah.
Wow. And it was just that it was every night, like one or two shows a night. It was
wow.
It was nuts.
Rockstar lifestyle.
I regret ever thinking it would be rad.
I need to bring us back quickly to an Ed Wood comparison. You know the moment where Ed looks at the dentist and sees yeah. Bela Lugosi. I'm not just saying this to you. I just had a moment where you're blocking from the mic, and I thought I was looking at Bud Cort from Harold and Maude. I'm not even kidding. This part of your hair, it was like almost uncanny across the eyes. I was like, that's amazing. It's Bud, my favorite.
Hopefully, I stay looking like Bud Cort and Harold and Maude, and not Bud Cort anytime after.
He's pretty good at that. Stranger in the Dark, or whatever.
Oh my God. Yeah, that was the thing that I hated so much when Adam Green asked me to be in. The Victor Crowley movie. Your scene takes place in the 60s, so you're going to need to shave completely. I was like, I don't really do that. I don't like the way I look with it. And then we get there, and I brought, like, you know, my framed glasses. I didn't have LASIK at the time. And actually, this is what kind of prompted me to get it. I had my old frames, which were vintage kind of looking. And the DP just was like, I don't want to bother with these reflections. Just lose the glasses.
Oh, no.
And I'm just feeling so – and, like, you know, I'm an actor, and I've acted as different variations of myself over the years and done things. But it was just one of those things where it's also like, oh, this is my first horror movie, something I've dreamed about since I was a kid, getting killed in the beginning.
You don't get to see any of it.
And it's, you know, I was up all day writing on my other show, Hidden America. Like, we had like a crazy like table read and a bunch of rewrites. And I was like, I got to go. Drove out into the desert and we did the scene. And when Kane Hodder showed up, it was just like so tense and scary and intimidating. They had me running through the brush at night. I couldn't see anything. And Adam yells, cut. And I stop and I put my glasses on. And there was this broken branch that if I had gone any further, would have went right into my eyes.
Oh, shit.
And that's so like, zombie, too.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. So close.
Low-budget horror filmmaking.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. It was a blast. And then, you know, just the rushing so hard because the sun's starting to come up. We still need to get my shot of the axe going through my head. And there was this part where I had to like kind of fall off to the side, and I went off to the side, and they were a real quick reset. And Kane Hodder, who had been, you know, he's in the Victor Crowley makeup. It's like everyone kind of gets quiet when he's on set, and it's really weird. And he's screaming every once in a while just to kind of build tension, I think, for everyone else involved. Me, it worked. And he did this thing where it's like I kind of came off, and I was just getting tired, and I kind of wobbled off the thing, and he's like, it was just this gentle, like, he was behind me, he put his arms, his hands on my shoulders, and then kind of pushed me back up, and they gave me a little tap on my shoulder. And then it was just like, you're doing great.
That's so sweet.
Yeah, it was very cool.
Sweet. I had to mention the cool thing about your scene in Victor Crowley, it's the opening scene, and your character's proposing to your girlfriend. We'd mentioned at the top of the show Dark Delicacies, which is a store that we frequent regularly in Burbank, and it's owned by Del Howison and his wife Sue, and the character, your name is Del, and you're proposing to your girlfriend Sue.
Aww.
It is, in fact, named after the Dark Delicacies owners.
We did
which I thought was really sweet.
We did a DVD signing there, and Del, like, Sue kept on going. He's like, "We got to get the two Dells in a picture together." And Del was just like, "He's like, yeah, we're about the same height."
And then hair's the same.
Yeah, exactly. But he was very excited. We're going to be doing a Mystery Science Theater DVD signing there.
Nice.
Oh, that's awesome.
I'm very excited.
Very
just like
cool.
That's like one of the neat things. It's like when you get involved in something where, you know, a shop that you've been going to since you moved to LA is like, hey, you should do something here. It's just like, oh, wow, this is the cool part, you know? That's why there was a weird bit of when I went to the Slashback video, it was this thing where I was so blown away by it, but I was also, oh, I'd be involved in this. Like, I was like, no, call me. I got a copy of a couple movies I can put in here.
Well, if you bring it back, some more videotapes.
We'll be talking.
I got the VHS app all ready to go.
I love it.
I also like that. I told you what the app was. You went and used it on one of your videos, and I received no credit.
What is a VHS app, and why have I not heard of this, guys?
It's pretty great. Yeah, it's fun. Shoots in 4:3. Yeah. You can before you shake it, the tracking messes up.
VHS, VHS cam.
I thought you meant a VHS cataloging app.
No. Yeah. It's like an app, a camera app on the phone.
It shoots.
That's cool.
That's cool.
I mean, well, tying it all back and wrapping it up, it's like that, the Dell signing, the going, you know, doing a Slashback video, you know, all these things, Hidden America. I mean, like that's, like that is, I feel like the culmination of chasing our dragon. It's like we now have new goals. Well, whereas a kid, we're like, what's new? What's new? What do we need? What do we want to gobble up? And then now we're kind of attaining that and transcending it by doing the cool shit, you know?
Yeah.
And then being there to like sign. I don't mean that.
Yeah, and realizing it doesn't fill any holes.
It's true. Like, it just makes new ones. Yeah. It really does. Yeah. But I think that for listeners, like the same thing is happening with conventions now. The idea of going to the convention and kind of being more part of it, I think it's definitely fun. It's part of the dragon.
All that's to say is the horror community is pretty cool.
Yeah.
They rad people.
Yeah.
They are.
Well, Jonah, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
A long time coming. And we really appreciate it.
Of course.